work session order and establish quorum. Roll call, please.
Dan Marco.
Kim Malinix.
Al Greiner.
Peter Martinez.
And Adele is absent for this session. Then let's have the Pledge of Allegiance, please. And Mayor Kitty, would you lead us?
My pleasure.
Pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And I think we'll get right into it. And for anybody that doesn't know, I'd like to introduce Pam Spires of USDA and take it away.
Take it away. Well, first of all, I'd like to take just a couple of minutes out of my spiel to tell you a little about what we do at the Redmond Area Office under the umbrella of USDA Rural Development. And we have four programs that we administer, 44 sub-programs. And we have single-family housing, which includes the direct and guaranteed loans for single-family housing, for those that qualify. It also has a component of low-interest loan, like about 1%, and grant for home repairs for those that qualify. There's an age and income criteria that you have to meet, but it's upwards of $7,500 in grant if you qualify. And the loan is amortized out for 20 years, and it's about $93 a month for a $20,000 loan. So it's very doable, whether you get a loan or the grant. We also have what we call multifamily housing, which are the cluster or apartment complexes that are scattered throughout Oregon. Some are for farm service housing, something like that. It's not one of the programs that work. But anyway, they're actually building a new one in Madras at the moment, and it houses low-income and ag-related income families. Then we have our third program is business, and we help new and emerging businesses. We're sort of a lender of last resort for business opportunities, both direct and guaranteed loans with commercial lenders on getting a business established or giving them the funds to expand or improve upon the business at hand. And then I work two programs, and they're under the umbrella of community programs. One is community facilities, and we have under that program, we do everything from building new hospitals, fire stations, city halls, daycare, libraries, shelters, animal and human. although I have yet to have any project come in and be turned down that would qualify as an essential community facility. Under that, we have direct loans, we have guaranteed loans with commercial lenders, and a very, very, very small amount of grant. It's usually around $200,000 for the entire state for the year, so it's almost nothing. And then I also have the infrastructure program, Rural Utility Service, which I underwrite loans for water and sewer projects. And I'm getting my hopefully, I'm getting my first geothermal project this year. So that'll be a new and an interesting prospect. So those are the that's the broad brush of the types of programs that we have available with the USDA Rural Development, and our office is in Redmond. We're out by the airport. We're on the north end of the parking lot of the airport on Salmon Avenue, and we would hope that you would take advantage of us. And if you have any questions or concerns about any of the programs, you just call the general number, hit 4, and we'll get you to the person you need to talk to. So, and I'm leaving with the council members a copy of our activity report for the last couple of years, and it has all of the contact information for the various programs available, and I also have included my business card and my immediate supervisor's business card, Barry LeSure. And we're, all of us are willing to sit and talk or come out, and, such as I'm doing tonight, and discuss our programs. Okay. The commercial is over. We'll get down to business.
That was very good.
Yes, thank you.
So, well, people say, what do you do? You know, well, that's what we do. Okay. I've been invited here tonight to give City Council an overview of what it is to do a transfer and assumption of loans and grants, okay? And so that you understand, I'm not just pulling things out of thin air. I have provided in your packet on the left-hand side the rules and regulations that govern why we have to do what we have to do. In section, if you turn, let's see, I've highlighted from section 12 to 15 in this rules and regulations that is what governs or is what our rural development instruction is based on. And I want to direct your attention to section 14 that's highlighted in green, section 14B. And it says the responsibility for initiating action in response to those actions prohibited by the prior section rests with the borrower. And I wanted to let you folks know that there is no problem doing a transfer and assumption of the loans and grants of the two of the water and sewer districts. But there is a process, and I have to follow the process because I have to make sure that the loans are secure from district to city, and that there isn't any lack of security for those federal funds, for your tax dollars, in that process. And so this is the regulation that holds my feet to the fire to make sure that that doesn't happen, that we don't slip up and somewhere along the way lose the security for those loans. Okay?
What is that? And, it says that they initiate the action. How complicated is the initiation?
Okay, it can, and I was going to get into that. It can happen a couple of different ways. And I have worked with both ways. One with the sewer district outside of Prineville. They actually went to the voters and said, we no longer want to be a sewer district. We want to be a sewer and water authority. And so, which was perfectly fine with us, but they went to the voters and did the ballot and the whole nine yards, and it was very clean. There was a paper trail the whole way, and once the authority was actually established by the state of Oregon and the county and Crook County, then the authority applied for the transfer and assumption of the loans from the sewer district. We didn't have anything to do with the water district. We had no loans with them whatsoever. And again, that's the only reason I'm sitting here today. If it wasn't for the fact that the districts didn't have the RD loans, I would have no business sitting here. And they had to apply, the authority had to apply, just like any new applicant for our funding for this transfer and assumption. And it went very, well, I can't say it went real smoothly because there's always glitches, but it went as smoothly as possible. And that took just a little under a year to accomplish because of the process that they went through, okay? I'm working with the Crescent Water District or Association that just became a district, a public utility district. And they just had sort of a yay by the membership, and before I knew it, their attorney had done a really good job of turning all this around pretty quickly, and we got theirs done within like about a 4 or 5 month period. You know, so it's going to take a block of time no matter what we do, but there are ways, you know, to do it.
Right. My question really is, what is, because I read all your things and so have they, we know it takes time.
Yeah.
So it's whether it's 3 months, 6 months, 5 years.
Right.
But it's the initiation, it comes to the initiation. What is required to initiate a letter? So all it needs is a letter on their letterhead saying, we want to initiate it.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's all it.
And how they do their process will dictate how long that's in that time frame.
Yeah, and just like those districts, we're following Oregon law. You know,
mm-hmm.
and we'll follow Oregon law. ORS 222 tells how we withdraw.
Right.
So that's a two-part discussion. One is, you know, you have the federal law, like you said, but those both examples you gave, what they were doing was following Oregon statutes.
Absolutely.
We plan on following Oregon statutes, but it's how do we get it started? And so you answered it, simply a letter. There's no other hoop at that point. They just need to send a letter.
They need to send a letter and start the process for the dissolution of the districts and have their attorney get them through that process. Ken Jones, isn't it?
Yep.
And Eugene. And starting through that process, and so that when the city takes over, at that point in time, the city needs to do the application process.
Sure.
Okay?
We can't apply until they've sent that letter.
Right.
Because I think I asked that.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
And then my understanding is that that's where you guys start the ORS 222?
Right, that's
right.
Do
the ordinance and all that?
And that's when the year starts, the 8 month starts, to go through it all.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. Because we have to see, the application process is that we have to see your organizational documents to assure that you have the ability to enter into a contract with the federal government. You do, but we start to look at the paperwork.
Sure.
We have to look at your finances and to assure that with city finances supplemented, yes, by the income from user rates, you know, will be sufficient to take care of the loans. If you're going to establish different user rates or put them in the language that reflects what the city desires, all of that, we need to see a draft copy of that as well.
Do you just transfer the loan with the same length, same rate, same interest?
Yes.
Do you rewrite the loan documents, or are they actually just the same with a different name?
We issue a new letter of conditions that reflect the existing revenue, GO, whatever bonds they are, and that we maintain the same interest rate and whatever is left, whatever term is left.
So if the department, since if they have a 10-year-old, I don't know how old your loans are, but if you have a 10 or 15-year-old one, and today you have different sets of kind of rules that go with those, are those inserted at that time, or do you take the rules for getting interest rate and terms, kind of the other stuff, some of the policies that you have?
Yes, absolutely. So that transfers right with, yes, absolutely. All of the requirements that were established with the original letter of conditions are in effect.
Okay.
Pam?
Yes?
Let's do a hypothetical sequence.
Sure.
They write the letter today. Now, what happens next? Just thinking about paperwork flow and the phone calls and stuff like that. Does this, the city starts the 222 process? Now that's really outside of your piece, I'm assuming.
Yes. Okay.
But they send the letter. So for USDA, you would do what?
Well, what I would do once I got the letter there is a list of items that are required that each district will have to submit to me, because I have to do what's called an eligibility review. And this laundry list of about, probably 8 to 10 items will have to be submitted and to our attorneys in Portland. The attorney will look
what
at it.
What does that list represent?
It represents everything from audits to the letter of conditions to the printout of what the existing loans are,
and that's
interest rates.
From
yes.
From the districts, okay.
So there's all that stuff that I've got to gather together, twice as much actually, because I'm working with two separate districts. And and I write my recommendations that I feel that, for example, the Lapine Water District was an eligible borrower way back when, that they have maintained their payment schedule. They're current with all of their audits. They, blah, blah, blah. And that we recommend that the OGC, the Office of General Counsel, our attorneys, we recommend that they approve the transfer and assumption of the existing loans and grants to the city of Lapine. And so then we sit around and wait for their response. And that will take probably about 3 to 4 weeks, depending on what their particular workload is, because they not only work with Oregon, they deal with Washington, Idaho, Nevada, and parts of California and Alaska. So,
okay,
it's
so
just not us.
So we've got that. You wrote the recommendation.
They come back with their concurrence or any follow-up that they feel that needs to be tweaked. And then once I get that blessing, I send that letter to the district saying that all is well. And that's the point in time when the city would make application.
And then you start reviewing us.
And then I start reviewing you. And
so we get a package.
So I will send you a packet that reflects what I need for a full application. The first thing we're going to do is an eligibility review of the city. And again, it's a looking at the legal documents, the charter, bylaws, articles of incorporation, blah, blah, blah. And our attorney looks at it to assure that all is copacetic and we can do business. Okay?
Okay.
Then they send back an all is well letter to me saying that we can go forward.
And that goes to GOC?
No, the letter comes from the attorney to our Portland staff. Portland staff issues me a letter saying that we can go forward with the full application.
Okay.
The full application will require some additional documentation, and I'll need, and I have all the forms for this, I'll need a legal agreement with the city's attorney, because they're going to have to review some of the documentation that we supply the city, to make sure that it fits the parameters of city ordinances. And then we don't have, thank goodness, we don't have to do preliminary engineering reports or environmental reports. That's all been taken care of years ago. But we do need a contract with your attorney. We'll need to see at least 2 years worth of audits, city audits. We're going to need to see your current council-approved budget. We're going to need to see your year-to-dates, and so that I can get, for my underwriting, I can get a real clear picture of what your income and outgo is, okay?
Okay.
I have a real quick question. Mm-hmm. I know the charter's up on the May ballot.
Mm-hmm.
How long after the vote does the charter become effective?
It becomes effective July 1. We actually operate under the state charter right now. We have a charter, just not Lapine, but we operate under ORS's. We have
charter. Yeah, I was just asking because I wanted clarity. I didn't want that.
You may end up starting with the state charter and then it switches to the charter. But both of them will allow borrowing, like you said.
Okay.
And because I haven't gone from district to city before, I'm not really clear on terms for this, but I think we're going to have to stay with the 30-year term that we issued to the district for the loans. But here again, I can clarify that.
Because you could tell them that cities can be 40.
Yes, cities can be 40 years.
But I don't see any reason for us to extend them. I mean, because there's no point in that. I mean, you want to pay them off as soon as you can. Yeah. These guys have been doing it, so.
And so we'll get through the eligibility review. We'll get through the full application. We'll issue the letter of conditions, and there's some paperwork that needs to be signed off on that. And once we issue the letter of conditions, then that gives me permission to do the actual transfer. That's where we transfer the loans and grants that have been under the tax ID of the districts, and we transfer them to accounts under the tax ID of the city. Okay? Along with all of this, depending upon the rate schedule that is submitted, as to whether or not our attorneys will tell us that we have to recapture any of the grant funds. I don't anticipate that, but I'm going to give you a heads up about it right now. That might be a possibility because one a transfer that I did with the district, and it wasn't the two that I previously talked about, there was a third one, that the new owner that we transferred the grant and grants and loans to actually had to pay back some of the grant money because they were grant is given to keep rates at what we call similar system rates so that apples to apples and oranges to oranges, the water district and the sewer district are paying pretty much the same rates as similar systems throughout the state of Oregon, okay, that have had new construction. And in this instance, the rates were actually lower when it was transferred to the new entity, and they had to pay us back. It was right around 80-some thousand. They had to pay back the grant portion of the grant. But it was on a percentage basis, so you won't ever have to pay the full grant back unless you do something really horrific. But it becomes a percentage, and the percentage is based upon how many years have passed between the giving of the grant and now. So just FYI, in case somebody in Portland says, excuse me, that this won't be new news to anyone.
Did that go from a public entity to a private entity?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, but it still isn't, that wasn't the reason it did that. The reason was that the rates of the district were higher than of the private company. And so...
Had they been the same?
Had they been the same, not a problem. Or had they been higher, not a problem. Yeah. But they were lower. Yeah. And so that is the purpose of the grant, is to keep those rates at that similar system level.
Seems reasonable, yeah.
And...
So then that sort of brings us up to the point of... the loan transfers.
Right, the loan transfers. We give you a piece of paper that is the actual transfer, and then what we do is we turn around and we do a forgiveness to the districts.
Okay.
Of all responsibility for those loans and grants, and that's all done at the same time.
When do the actual record keeping and everything transfer from the districts to the city?
Not until the transfer is completed.
Right. Okay, so
that's after the letter of conditions is issued, that's after all of this review and paperwork is accomplished, and we do the, and I send Rick an email showing that the funds have been transferred under the city's tax ID number, and I can show actual screen prints of that and send it to him.
Yeah. Okay.
So Pam, tell me, when can they actually conduct business?
Not until the transfer.
Yeah, until the transfer. So they couldn't do anything until that point. They cannot conduct any business.
Because that's the security that we have, is that even though the districts have formally dissolved, you still have the responsibility until that actual transfer of maintaining payment, collection of fees, the whole nine yards, maintenance of operation and maintenance of it, and then the day that we transfer the funds.
Do you pick that day, kind of like a title close? In other words, you get it all done and you say, okay, we're ready, and it's the 10th of something. Yeah. I mean, you say, We'll do it on the first of the next month, or whatever. Is that, I mean, we would pick a date, because you don't just all of a sudden one day, you send me an email 3 o'clock, then the next day. I mean, so obviously, you say it's done, it's ready, it's kind of like the closing on a title. You pick a date that we agree, so that, actually you probably pick it out a month or two, because you need the public to know, you need everyone to know.
But it takes 6 days. Once we request the transfer in St. Louis, it takes 6 days before we get notification that transfer has actually taken place, because they notify your congressional reps first, and so that they have a heads up about it, okay? And then we get a letter that we issue to you saying that all is well, and then at that point in time you pick, like you said, a date to do the actual transfer of employees or whatever it is you're going to do. So, just to give you a...
Bond counsel.
Huh?
Do they need to hire bond counsel like we did?
That may be part of the process, but again, because the other two were in-house, we didn't have to do it. So... let me get that clarification, and I don't think you're going to have to, because it's there's no new bonds. It's the same bonds under the same regs, under the same conditions, blah blah. And so as I'm sitting here, I'm going to say no to the bond counsel, but I will certainly follow up.
I just wanted to ask, because I know they're not cheap.
No, they're not. The cost to the city is certainly going to be the attorney fees.
Right.
Trying to think what else that...
is there any way you can estimate that so they can budget for it?
Well, you're going to have to, if you don't have a attorney of record, you're going to have to put out a request for a proposal for one.
And we have
they do.
Okay. And then ask. Ask them what it's...
But they don't know the work that's involved. But we'll have... we'll make sure this
they
continues.
They can certainly give me a call.
Yeah.
And I can, give them a ballpark idea of what it is they're going to have to do. and...
we can do that.
Hey, one thing. What's the... even before the letter is submitted mm-hmm. for the possible transfer, and after the letter is submitted till the transfer is complete, the Water and Sewer District are governed by their own rules and regulations by their elected leaders. Is that not correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
the city
right
takes no
under state rule.
Yeah, the city cannot take any responsibility for those districts until the actual transfer.
Yeah, I understand that, and that mm-hmm. wasn't. I wasn't trying to get into that. I just wanted to make sure
yeah.
that they would have a governing body that would take care of
yes.
it in a caretaker situation once
right.
the letter is written.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Just to give you a sense of what the. Outstanding loan amounts are the balances. I went in this afternoon. Total loans for the water district is $2,783,499. Total grant that go along with those loans is $1,798,500. For the sewer district, the outstanding balance on their loan is $159,111. And the grant that's associated with that loan is
$120,188.
Sewer
doesn't have much debt.
No, no.
Would it ease the process at all? If sewer just paid that loan off?
Oh, absolutely. Then that's one less review we have to do.
Okay.
And one less loan they have to apply for.
Okay.
Yeah, when I was looking at it, I was surprised how little, it's just because they've had
that's
so long.
More than that.
Cause that's
I thought it was more than that.
Well, I think they've paid down faithfully on it.
Yeah.
And they've been very frugal and not taking any extra debt. Oftentimes when they've done repairs or they've done major upgrades, they've been able to do it at a very cheap cost.
Yeah. It was, their loans were closed, or that loan was closed in 86.
Yeah.
So it's an old loan.
Yeah. And then when they did some additions, they didn't really have to take out much money to do those additions. When they did Wikia, they just paid for it. When they did the, they got some grants and some help from the state to redo mm-hmm. their ponds and stuff. That didn't cost any extra money really. Had they had taken a loan out on that, that would have been a much greater cost to the repairs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pam, that grant would just disappear. So the amount of repay would be...
If you're not assuming the loan, there is no grant.
Okay. Okay.
So...
Okay.
Thank you. The next part, are you done with all that kind of stuff? Basically, how we kind of do that?
Yeah, you don't want to go into all the regs. I've
no.
kept you copying our regs.
But what I want to talk about,
you guys can read,
is explain a little bit, because I talked to Sam Goldstein about it, and Brian has talked to us a little about it, and you know, so we want to get a feel for, and you mentioned it kind of in this grant thing. So on the rates, you know, we let RCAC come give a presentation about rates and how rates are set and what you can and can't
mm-hmm.
do. Tell me what you're, just why don't you walk me through from your perspective on what's USDA's role, because I get a little bit of a different, Sam acted like, call up, and this has been very broad, that your review of that is fairly broad. In other words, you're not micromanaging the district or their rates.
No.
And I got the impression in some others that you really do, you're getting down there. I mean, if they got a $26 rate and it was $27 or $25, or if you had extra money, you have to pay it against a loan. So I just walk through to me, so I understand it better. And he also told me that they are in new loans, they're not even near as involved in rates, yeah. is what he said.
Your user rates have to cover certain things to keep your infrastructure viable. And those include your operation and maintenance, your normal operation and maintenance, whatever that number is. And that's part of the budget development of the board or council. debt service. It has to be enough that each EDU or equivalent dwelling unit or residential unit pays a certain portion of their user rates are that reflect part of that debt service and reserve. It has to reflect short-lived assets. Short-lived assets are the mechanisms within the system that have a 1 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 15 year life cycle, and that have to be replaced. Because what we have found in the past is that we've had to go back and replace.
This is a new thing.
Yeah, we've had to go back in the past and literally rebuild infrastructure systems because, well, let's just say there was deferred maintenance. In other words, nobody bothered to make sure that these mechanisms were ever replaced. They were, you know, a wing and a prayer that kept the place going. So, National Office finally wised up to this fact and declared and that we would, from henceforth, require our borrowers to reflect in their annual budget a line item for these short-lived assets. And then, so we've got just regular operation and maintenance, we've got debt service reserve, and we have short-lived assets. It would also be good to throw in depreciation, because that also helps with the physical plant or the building, you know, that it gives you a little reserve to.
You have to fund depreciation.
We would like you to.
So you don't have to.
You don't
you
have
just
to.
Fund depreciation.
No. But we do the, we just started doing the short-lived assets a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it was a requirement. I think the latest budget I sent you shows that on there.
Yeah. It's hard to fund depreciation, but it is good, or at least try to.
Yeah.
But I understand why you can't.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's those components that go in to make up your user rate.
Okay.
Those are the components that I look at when every year you submit your financial statements and that year's budget, approved budget, because I have to assure, I have to go into our underwriting system and every year for the life of the loan plug in what these rates are, how many users are on the system, so you have to keep track of that, so that we can be assured that there is going to be adequate funding for the infrastructure to cover all of these.
And the districts currently meet your requirements.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So my question is, if we, through a consolidation, because sometimes there's some economies of scale and mm-hmm. different things, and we saved, I mean, you pick a number, $25,000 a year out of, you know, $500,000 budget, which isn't all that much, but say $25,000 or $50,000 out in both districts. But so you saved $25,000. And all those other things are funded, just as they've always been, the reserves and all that you require. So we have this extra $25,000. Can the council decide to pay down the loan? Can they decide to put it to fund depreciation? Could they, if it came out to a $2 a month decrease in rates, can they lower rates, or do they have to keep it the same and just bank the money? Or as long as those other things are done, do you not care?
All of the above. And that's the short answer. We would like to see the depreciation funded, but what about your capital improvements?
Yeah, well,
you know, as long as you budget for capital improvement, not just the short-lived assets, but for the rehabbing of the tank.
But you don't have a requirement that if we save money, it has to go against a loan.
No.
Okay. So we could start funding depreciation. We could possibly lower rates. We could possibly do some of both. funds at origination, yes. Lower rates.
And there is
whatever.
No prepayment penalty to our loans.
Okay.
So you could pay it off the day you got it.
That's kind of what Sam told me. There really is flexibility. So
absolutely.
If we save money, it is an advantage. It's not just that you just hand it over to the USDA.
No. But it has to stay for the system.
Yep.
Oh, sure.
Yep.
Typically, what we've done is we funded our capital improvements account to ensure that we have money to replace those larger assets as they fail. And that's what we've done with any savings. When we took on WikiUp Junction, we found that we actually came out better, farther ahead than we initially thought. We came out and we actually gave more money and had more money to pay things. And so instead of taking that money initially paid down the loan, we instead funded that capital expenditure account so we could set more reserves aside for future expansion or replacing those major assets.
Right.
Which, I mean, I'm all for it. We need to do that. What you're doing there is perfect.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing RCA mentioned, and this comes up a lot, and it gets people feathers a bit ruffled because of economic development growth, and this gets to SDCs. And what RCAC told us, the perception always is, you know, everyone hates SDCs, you know, they're the monster in economic development. Whether or not that's true is...
I don't view it that way.
No. Whether or not it's true is actually a fair discussion,
right.
But it's perceived to be, at least, and it can be at times. So, what's your requirement, I guess, or how do you factor in the required SDCs? If we had one, we had an annual one built, we wouldn't have collected a dollar anyway in this last year, hardly. RCAC acted like, he said, they're funded through you. They said, you know, we don't care, you know, if you have an SDC or not. Ultimately, they look at just how you're, if you save, basically you can charge $5 more a month to the ratepayer and have no SDC. I mean, it's the bottom line is more of, it's the dollars that come in. And so the idea is you could cut the SDC in half if we chose to, as long as it doesn't. And if we save, in other words, if we save $50,000 a year in operational costs, we could lower the SDC proportionately, of which your estimate's going to come in, same amount of money, because we lower our operating costs, and we then lower our SDCs. He acted like, that's fine. Is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay.
You have, all the SDC is to cover the construction of the infrastructure to that new subdivision or that new business going in or whatever, so that it doesn't become a drain on the rest of the users to subsidize that. And, you know, that they need to pay their fair share to get on the system.
There's always a debate over what that fair share is.
Absolutely.
Well, and that's how the sewer district was able to do all of WikiUp Junction without any funding.
If I'm hearing this properly, or the way I'm hearing it, we can take the budget you have set up right today and transfer that or attach it to the budget of the city, and we should be able to go on and maintain the same services with the same employees and reduce the loans just as you have been. Is that correct?
Absolutely, sir.
Any more? You guys have any comments or questions? Dan, you're down there studying.
I had something. I got answered a long way, so that's...
Well, you've done a good job.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Really helpful.
Well, there's going to be, you know, all of this is sort of like deer in headlights at the moment. Yeah, I understand that. You have my business card. Give me a call. On that business card, write down my cell number, please. And it's 541-914-6815.
What was the last one?
6815.
Yes.
Call me.
And I might be able to help answer a dumb question here. You never know.
Yeah. And because once this kind of filters through and you have a little bit of time to think about it, other questions are going to pop up. And rather than sitting and stewing about it, give me a call. And I want to make this, you know, as easy a transition assumption as we possibly can. I know Rick, that's his desire as well. Donna, her desire. And so rather than, you know, have you sit there and fester with a question, call me.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks.
I think everybody on the council wants to do it with the least amount of pain possible. I don't think anybody sitting at this table wants to beat up anybody else.
No,
I mean, that just
not at all.
Isn't at least it's not my thought, and I'm sure it isn't.
Okay. So
take a recess, Mr. Mayor. Mm-hmm. Take at least 15-minute recess.
We need to adjourn.
So
I'd like to call the work session of the City Council to order. And we'll have a roll call, please.
Dan Brooker.
Adele McAfee.
Kim Molenix.
Tom Grider.
Stuart Janish.
And we have all the councilors here. Let's get with it.
Okay. For the record, my name is Deborah McMahon, and James Lewis is with me to my right. And together we are implementing the grant that you received to create ordinances that will enforce the policies in the comprehensive plan. And just as a refresher, the comprehensive plan sets the broad picture with policies, programs, and goals and objectives and all those good things. And then the ordinances, like zoning ordinance and procedures ordinance, those are more regulations that implement what you wanted to see in the comprehensive plan. There are six codes that have been prepared for your review that have been handed out to you previously and sent to you on an email. Procedures ordinance, which is the guidelines for how permits are processed. The subdivision ordinance, how land is split up or combined, including planned unit developments and master plans. The zoning ordinance, which make sure that there are rules and guidelines for each zone that the city has. Sign code, which is obvious. The lighting ordinance, which protects the dark sky. And then an SDC policy that gives you a good framework on how you could approach the implementation of systems development charges. One of the most important things that the Planning Commission wanted to forward, in addition to their recommendation for approval on these codes, are some policy issues. And they wanted to make sure that the Planning Commission knew that they felt strongly about two specific things. One, that there has to be some level of enforcement. Otherwise, there's no reason to have codes in place. And that there needs to be a healthy discussion at the right time on how the city and county manage the change in jurisdiction for enforcement of those codes. That's pretty common sense. That was a good discussion that we had at the Planning Commission level, and they forward that to you. The other concept is, in all of these codes, it's important to be business friendly. Lapi needs to grow, it needs to accommodate growth in a proper way, but it should not create obstacles to economic development. And that was the second broad concept that they wanted to forward to you. Was there anything else, Gloria, that I missed?
John's back there too.
John, sorry. In terms of broad policy concepts.
Yeah, that is a broad concept. That's a little to say about a lot of discussion, but...
And we'll cover more as we go on, because we'll have context. Out of the six ordinances, we thought, with your permission, it would make sense to start with the zoning ordinance, because that's kind of the meat and potatoes of how the city will be managed. Is that okay with you?
It'll probably take the longest and get the most input from the citizens as well.
Yes.
Okay.
For me,
did you all have time to glance through the codes and get a feel for them?
Okay. I'm sure you have it.
I do.
Okay, well, the document looks like this. Any typos, errors, so formatting things will be taken care of. You need an extra?
Yep, there's a zoning code.
I do.
That was stupid.
No problem.
Thank you.
One of the things that you should not be distracted by are typos or formatting errors, so don't worry about that. Ken has kindly offered to give me his set pointing out some of those things, so we'll get those fixed up. On page Roman numeral 4,
You've got the title, which identifies legally what ordinance this is. The purpose and authority, which is generally replicating the kinds of things that you see in the comprehensive plan. We want orderly development. We want to lessen congestion on roads. We want public health and safety. All good things. On the next page, you'll see under section 201, specific objectives. And these define more clearly the kinds of things that the city would like to accomplish. Okay. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because it's about community character and livability and concepts that we have been, quite frankly, going on and on and on about for a very long time. If you look at the application process, we feel, and the Planning Commission felt, that when there's new land use activity in the city, that it should be reviewed and regulated to some extent. And that's the purpose of this code. So when a person is applying for example, a new building that's commercial, a commercial building, they'll need to go through a process to make sure that their setbacks are met, it's a proper use in the zone, the height is met, all of those things that are typical for land use regulation. We also have in Article 3 definitions. There's a lot of terminology here about what is a use, what is the floodplain, definitions of open space and structure. All of these things are important because when your customers come in and they need to submit a burden of proof describing to you what they want to do in the city, definitions of terms become more and more important. So that's why those are in there. You'll also see in section 400, we've described all of the zones that are on the zoning map. So we have residential zones, mixed-use commercial, a variety of other commercial zones, transitional areas, industrial, light industrial, forest, floodplain, and riparian areas. And the Planning Commission, at the very end of the process, we had discussed that the state wanted us to have more information about the floodplain and the riparian areas and the setbacks, and that came up in our acknowledgement process too. So some of the things they said at the state level, we've already put into our plan, so we're making progress in this document. So if you turn to section 500, which is the start of the residential zones, you'll see in the gray box the RSF and RMF zones, which is single family and multifamily. And on the left side, you'll see principal uses. These are the things that you want to see happen in the zone as a primary use. And those are listed for you, starting with single family homes and then going down to bed and breakfast establishments and essential services. Essential services includes all of your public and private utilities. And the reason we put this as an outright permitted use is because we don't want any monkey business or appeals later on when somebody's digging a ditch to extend a sewer line or a water line or an overhead electrical line. Those are essential services that every home or business needs, and we don't want those hung up in any legal process. So we've called those as an outright permitted use or a principal use.
And just what I do a lot when Deborah and I present this is kind of take it back to how this works with other sections of the code. And the definition section we went through defines essential services. So when you see things in here and you kind of wonder, what does that mean? It's in the definition section. So that's what Deborah was just referring to. So
and
very important section.
Yeah, it works hand in glove and protects you long term. Under conditional uses, it's important to realize that these are uses that are allowed in the zone. They just require more scrutiny or perhaps conditions. That's why they're called conditional uses. So these are things that you might not normally find in residential zones. They might be things that already exist in the plan. And we start with large land area commercial recreation. We run through everything from churches, vet clinics, personal storage units, government buildings, specialized animal raising, care and processing, which we'll get into more detail on when we talk about fowl and animals and the limitations per acreage, campgrounds, recreational parks. We've kept this pretty clean. And if you continue on to the next page, you'll see additional language about accessory uses. Now, you're starting to see the framework of how this code is set up. In the shaded areas, a developer can easily go, or a citizen, or a homeowner, or a vacationer, can go to this code and quickly see on a chart what's allowed in each zone. Not going to have to fumble through. It's a quickie chart. If a use is missing, we're adding a section called exceptions that if the City Council and Planning Commission agree, you can grant exceptions to either add uses and allow people to do things that maybe aren't specifically listed here. So that's a good thing to have because it gives you flexibility.
A couple things though. As you go through each zone, you'll see some sections, obviously the commercial section allows retail uses, commercial uses that you don't see in your residential section. It was with 4-5, Deborah made me think of this when she said that there's some uses that you don't see listed. If they're not listed in as being allowed either permitted outright or conditional or an accessory use in that zone, that means it's with 4-5 that it wasn't appropriate for that use in that zone. If there was something like big box store, you're not going to see it listed in the residential zone because it's not appropriate to stick it in the middle of the neighborhood. So if you don't see something listed in there, it was with, again, just remember, it's with forethought that it was intended that it not be allowed in that zone. One other thing that I always like to point out is that on the conditional uses, people tend to think of those as uses that you tend to think of them in a negative light, like they're not allowed in the zone, and you have to do something special to have them permitted in the zone. I think of them as they're uses that are customarily in residential zones, like a church you will find in and around where people live. But in all locations, it may not be appropriate in all locations, or it may have impacts that are derogatory to the primary intent of that zone, which is where people live in their houses. So you can have a church, but you may have to impose conditions on it, like the parking lot needs to be shielded and screened so that you don't have headlights shining in people's windows, things like that. So it's just a way to make those uses, it's saying they're allowed in the zone, but more compatible with what the overall intent of that zone is.
As you're looking at the format, you'll see all the different zones and everything's principal use, conditional use. As you move through to the RMP zone, and this is the Newberry neighborhood, the county lands that are platted, and we pull over from the county code the regulations that are in effect today. That way property values are maintained. People who've already purchased property in there will have consistency with the codes. We did not see anything that would be inconsistent with our comprehensive plan or any of the visions of the Planning Commission. So you'll see a reference to the county code, and we just pulled it completely over without changing anything. I think otherwise we'd be subject to some legal arguments about property rights, and we didn't want to go there. In the traditional commercial zone, which is what we often think of as the downtown, the more dense commercial area, the principal uses start off with retail sales and then go all the way down to vet clinic. The kinds of things that you'd see in that zone are cafes, needing establishments, business, professional, government offices, etc. Under conditional uses, this is a good one where you'll see some transition or existing pattern where it's okay to have a single family home. Whether it's above a business or already in existence because of historical patterns, that's fine. And then we also want to limit, in some cases, auto-dependent uses. So anything that emits fumes or noxious odors, like car paint booths and things like that, those really belong in the industrial zone, but there might be a place in the traditional commercial zone where that's appropriate. So that's why it's in the conditional use side and not allowed as a principal use.
I have one thing. And when you read these uses in the commercial zone, as you read them, they're fairly broad and not specific. It says retail sales, offices, and their zoning ordinances in the past would be very specific. They would list bookstore, they would list, candle store, and they would. So if you had something that didn't fit in that list, remember I was saying if it's not on your list, it's not allowed in that zone, it was very limited. You would have to say that it's not allowed in the zone. By keeping it fairly broad in general, it allows for interpretation so that, you know, as the economy changes and you have computer stores, it was something that 20 years ago you didn't, wasn't on that specific list. It gives you the ability to adapt. You know, if you list lawyer's office and architect's office and you know, real estate office, but you didn't list accountant, you couldn't have any accountants go into this zone. So that's why it's written in that fashion.
Did you guys take, did you keep Huntington, you didn't split like 97 different than Huntington? You kept it the same type of commercial?
Well, you've got different zones along.
I'm talking downtown 97.
Downtown? No, it's all purple.
Okay.
So it should be the same on both sides.
So you, yeah. So yeah. You get the Highway 97 from 1st to 6th the same as you did on Huntington.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't see a change. We've added some mixed-use areas in other places, but most of that's homogenous.
Because the downtown on Huntington, and I know in some communities that would be where they wouldn't allow a new gas station or something, but you do.
We do.
You would say they need to be on 97 where the traffic is. You don't want them down where you have your quaint little shops and things, but
there's flexibility there. And one of the things the Planning Commission was very strong about is that they didn't want a million-page ordinance.
I agree.
They wanted to keep it tight. And
you can always add to it.
You can always add to it, and retail sales, you know, you don't need to describe 1,000 of them. If it's retail, it's retail.
And there's a lot of case law and history out there as to what's retail and what's not. So, I mean, it gives you that latitude to work with people that are coming to your town and not immediately have something that's in black and white that turns out to be an obstacle to someone developing or doing something good in your community.
In the mixed-use commercial zone, which is the CRMX zone, you'll see that... Why aren't there pages on here? Well, that's disappointing.
It's first section. Just
the first section doesn't have page numbers, but it's corrected later on.
So that's just one triangle on the other side of First Street. Reed Road.
Yeah.
North of it, the triangle. Yeah. I'm assuming it's this.
The blue one.
Yeah. So here's Reed. There's McDonald's and everything. And so just that triangle.
Yeah. We want more center development. You could make it very shallow strip development, but this code encourages more center development. Principal uses are all listed as they should be, and then we have what we call accessory uses. Those are typical things that are incidental and subordinate that you don't really want to spend a lot of time regulating. It could be a small storage shed for air equipment or something like that, an overhang for parking, those kinds of things we're not going to spend a lot of time regulating. The neighborhood commercial zones list all of the similar uses, but with an emphasis on being a buffer between traditional neighborhood and heavier commercial.
Is this, didn't you have someone requesting that? Was it, there was someone at one of the public meetings?
Yeah, that was light industrial.
Okay.
He wanted light industrial, and we put that in. So moving on, we're in the transitional areas. And these are, the buffer zones between uses. And typically, these are going to be areas that have master plans so that we can see what's happening instead of just allowing strip development. So where you have the crosshatched areas.
And these areas right here, all those crosshatched areas, and right here. And it's because you have, for example, industrial right next to residential. So what we're trying to do is allow a type of development pattern that will be compatible with the industrial and the residential and not have that harsh, you know, out your back door is the boundary, so to speak.
It has to be master planned. Otherwise, it could be done very poorly. Then we get into light industrial zone, which, as you just mentioned, came up during a public meeting where a gentleman said, look, we need something a little more flexible in certain areas, so we did provide that. And you'll see in the principal uses, you have all your standard industrial establishments, but then you have call centers and research, development. You've also got the coffee shops and delis that the gentleman had asked for, barbershops, salons, up to a certain square footage. So it doesn't dominate, but it enhances that particular
zone. And that's the existing industrial park, basically.
Correct.
Yeah.
We got the same color, that map's outdated.
Yeah, we just have it updated. This is the old map, but it's this area right here. Again, the reason why there's limits on the size of some of those, which are traditional types of retail types of businesses, is that it allows flexibility for the land use, but what it does is it serves as, for people living and working, people working in that area, it serves their daily needs to go get lunch, to go possibly to the bank, but it doesn't draw people from all over the community to come there as a commercial business.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Where Adele knows from Ben.
Yeah, it's a tough thing.
Industrial, that light industrial where people, you start out with some warehouses, and then pretty soon the roller rink moves in to do roller skating, and then they try the flea markets, and it really causes, and you'll always battle this one. Because right now you got a repair shop back there, that repair company, that's about it in that new part. And that's clearly light industrial, but that's a toughie.
Yeah.
And you will fight that.
And a lot of times it's linked to property values, that sometimes you can get light industrial property that is valued or less expensive to purchase than true commercial property. Yep. And people want to purchase that so that they can put their commercial business on property that's cheaper to purchase. I mean, just stands to reason. So.
There's one problem that comes up when you mix uses like that, and you have to handle it very carefully. In the industrial zones, sometimes you'll have gases and flammable materials and caustic materials and poisons. And the fire department gets very concerned when you have people congregated next to these potential hazardous areas. That's the one thing you always have to keep in the back of your mind is when you start mixing things, got to be cautious of what your fire department will allow you to do. So that's one thing to be mindful of.
Well, you said that the hatched areas have to be master planned out.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they'll go through a planned unit development process. Well, they'll submit a site plan, showing how uses are integrated. Instead of just, I want a business here, and I'm not going to think about, where the pedestrians are going to walk and where the parking is. We want that to be very carefully thought out. And the Planning Commission will go through those plans with a checklist of things that need to be addressed so that after everything's developed, it all links and works together and streets are connected and open spaces are connected.
The example would be in the hatch section along Burgess Road. Under the county's plan, they have that basically all is single-family residential. And what you've seen or you experience in other communities is to have your single-family home back up against a major arterial roadway with all that traffic. It's not the most conducive or desirable. So it kind of shoots itself in the foot as a zoning designation on that property because not a lot of people want to live with their back to that road. So what it allows maybe a master plan to transition where you might have some possibly some live-work units or some multifamily units, which are more transitional, rented out along the roadway with the transitions then into traditional single-family residential as you get away from the road. So it allows them flexibility with a development pattern that's actually desirable rather than to be the last piece that might be developed.
In this standard industrial zone, you'll see things that you would expect, sawmills, but we also allow truck transportation, storage units, government buildings, power and energy generation facilities like BioGreen, things like that. So this is your heavier industrial area. It's usually furthest away from residential zones. Conditional uses reflect some things that could occur in the community, which would be mineral excavation, which includes soil excavation, parks and recreation trails, and then, of course, always accessory uses. And this is something that you need to be mindful of. In the industrial zone, people manufacture things, but they also need a showroom to present them to the public and have a retail component. That's normal. It only gets out of hand when it's more than 50% of the total structure area. So you'll see in accessory uses, we have a limit. And that way you've got some control and you can preserve your industrial areas for their primary use. So if a plumbing manufacturer goes in there, he's in the back casting things, but in the front you've got an opportunity to buy. And we think that's a good way to proceed. In the floodplain overlay zone, this is something that we have to do. And we have that identified on the zoning map. It's consistent with the flood emergency management. It's FEMA again.
Federal Emergency Management Agency.
I always forget that. That map is set by the federal government showing the limits of the floodplain and guidelines for how you develop in that zone. So we have that on our map. We refer to that here.
And to actually to get flood insurance, you have to have provisions like this in place.
What is the status of the outlying areas around, like, floodplain? I think we talked about it earlier, riparian and wetlands.
Mm-hmm. We have.
Are we looking for a new map? Is there a?
Remember the state said there was one tiny section of the Little Deschutes that we had to put in our plan as a potential study area, and make a policy saying we will study this and we'll have it completed in X number of years. And that's what they wanted us to do for a very small portion of the that crosses that yellow area right next to Roslyn.
Right.
And until we study it, what they said, they have kind of some basic, what they call safe harbor provisions under the state law. So for setbacks away from the river, you can use what they consider is if you establish your setbacks and your building restrictions according to what they say is safe, then they leave you alone. But you can better delineate where the wetlands are, where the riparian areas are that are of value, but that ends up becoming part of a study that you end up having to do and pay for. So that's something, right now you can take the safe harbor, which is what we're recommending, and then Deschutes County is going to be going through and updating the riparian and wetland.
We'll absorb as much as we can.
That would be part of it, so you could maybe utilize what.
Yeah, I think there might be a question that really brought me to this is the fact that they fly over an area, take a picture, and if the grass is green, it's a wetlands.
Mm-hmm. That won't be in our case. We will have to study it on the ground, measure it out.
Who is we?
The city. And with X number of years, we'll have to show exactly where's the high water mark, where's the bank, how does it affect this property. It'll be a more detailed examination of how that river affects the property.
A lot of this is under federal law or federal requirements and state law, state requirements too, with regard to your setbacks from infill and removal and things like that in the wetlands and in the riparian area. And it's based upon a map that the scale of which, I mean, it's hard to scale it off. So what the state law allows, and it's no different than what's been in place under the county ordinances for years, but what they allow is if you want to prove or you dispute what we have on our maps, and they know the error of these large-scale maps, you can have it surveyed in or you can have the wetland delineated, and they will accept that wetland survey or that floodplain survey of the property. It goes as part of their application, so potentially people can build closer to the river than what the floodplain map says. So property, it's an expense that they have to do. For example, a floodplain survey, it says what the elevations are. You can get a survey out there actually map where those elevations cross the property, and you may end up gaining 30 or 40 feet from what the map shows that the federal government has produced. Okay. So that's an option. You have that option. People have that option.
Under the forest and resource transition areas, we had this on the map. It caused a little bit of excitement at the state level. And Richard Whitman, who was in charge of DLCD, will probably come back again, suggested that we make that public facilities as a way to get through the state process in an easier fashion.
Instead of forest and resource?
Yeah. And you'll see that makes sense. We're preserving that land for large lot industrial development as well as energy production and sewer treatment expansion. Mm-hmm. So whatever we call it, public facilities is a more precise word, makes sense.
We'll see if we're successful.
And initially, I mean...
But don't be a naysayer.
But on the issue of whether that could be considered as part of the UGB, the whole size of the UGB issue.
Family wetland.
This is what we came up with initially to say, okay, well, if we keep what is typically a resource zone, right, what you find outside the city limits, inside the city limits, and you look at the uses that aren't allowed, it effectively locks it up, which is what they wanted, from further development until such time it's needed. So it did what they wanted it to do, it just didn't do it in a fashion that they were used to and comfortable with. So
we're going to tighten it up and see if we can't pass the bar.
Annie didn't like it.
No, Annie didn't like it.
Yeah, well, He's just one.
And he brought my curse with him.
We'll work on it. Okay, the last zone for you is one very similar to what we talked about, is the Little Deschutes and the Pine Slough riparian areas. Those need to be identified on the map and will be. This was asked to be added to the code by the DLCD reps, and it makes sense because it is the area where we'll do further study and identify any impacts from the river and the city. So that will be coming up later. We'll see in the next section. I just want to...
Can I ask something before you go into the next section? In the very first section under condition of use, you on the RSF and RMF,
yes.
The very first section, you reference Recreation Vehicle Park 701.6, and I just didn't see any text for 701.6. I just...
We'll fix that.
Yeah, it just needs to come out of there.
Yeah.
The references to like the original draft.
We'll connect that, but it's in the document.
Okay, and then is that the only zone where you can do that, or are the other ones just omitted because you can do it in the other zones, so it's not mentioned?
You can do it in other zones. It is permitted. It's restricted in the residential zones, and I believe we have that in conditional uses and light industrial is parks and recreation.
Parks and Recreation?
Yeah.
So campground is parks, okay.
We've got a variety of areas where that can be inserted.
Yeah, that was 701.6.
No, that's, a reference to just an initial draft.
But we'll connect the dots on
just
that.
Like we do
okay, and the other thing is, in some places you have references to trails, but not very many places, and we... Some of us are hoping that we put some trail systems in the area, and, even in Crescent Creek, what's designated as Crescent Creek that has trails, I don't see that trails are allowed.
With regard to trails, trails are not considered a... you could consider them a use, but typically it's an amenity or a public facility that's part of a use of a property.
Okay.
So where trails are referenced a lot is in the subdivision and land division code, specifically when people are creating subdivisions. For example, like in the county's master planned area, part of their master plan, as they divide the property, they're building sections of the trail.
Because you do have it mentioned in some of these places.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's... I don't think it's anything that really needs to be listed as a use. We could certainly do that because it's quite inappropriate to list it. But
if it's listed in industrial,
as a use,
it would be listed in residential. So I'm thinking just take it out entirely.
Or I would think, or just add it in to be clear. Just add it to include where it's not allowed. I think this should just be allowed in every zone.
Yeah.
It just be definitely clear that they're allowed in every zone.
We'll make that correction. It looks like we have it in quite a few. We just have to fill in the rest.
Maybe I just missed it.
That's okay. Okay, so as we're moving on, you'll see the language that was pulled directly from the county code for the Deschutes County Newberry Neighborhood Planning Area. And I'm not going to go through that in detail, but it's pretty standard stuff, what's allowed, what the setbacks are, etc. And then if you go to the section that is a chart that describes the size of lots, the density standards, lot width, lot depth, it'll look like this. And it too is in chart fashion so that anybody going through the code is able to figure out what their setbacks are and how big the lot has to be, etc.
Yep.
And that's important for the administration of that new neighborhood.
And that section jives with this section here in terms of just the uses.
Yeah.
So neighborhood one and neighborhood two is what? How do you? What's the difference? What's the
In the Newberry area, you can see them on the map. I think it's one.
Oh, those neighborhoods.
Yeah, those neighborhoods. On page 39, we finally have some page numbers. You'll see the floodplain overlay standards. And this references the county code format. The floodplain insurance map has been adopted by the county for Lapine, so we'll continue to use that, which makes us eligible for insurance, until we do our own mapping. And eventually over time, because we're an incorporated city, that will occur. But for now, we have to use the counties.
And most of the things in the floodplain zone or overlay zone, I mean, essentially we've seen uses permitted outright in the conditional uses. I think those just need, because it's going to be an overlay zone and not a base zone, we would end up pulling these out and just make the references we have it in the chart, where it just says all the uses allowed in the underlying zone are allowed in the floodplain overlay zone. But the reality is most of the provisions of this section get at how you build something in the floodplain zone, and you just meet the requirements for for construction. So
you're basically going to have to build up a couple feet.
Exactly.
Like
you mean in height?
Uh-huh. And certify, for example, you end up having to do things like certify that the foundation, the first floor level is 1 foot above the base flood elevation, and the foundation has openings in it to allow pressure to be equalized during, yeah, exactly.
So do we have any floodway through town or not?
Yes, the floodway is this thread of the stream.
We don't have anything that's actually, I mean, outside of the actual stream that's a floodway.
Well, you think of this, where the water is the floodway, right, the stream, the wet area. Then you've got different types of riparian areas, and then the upland area.
Yeah. But so my there. Question is, we have no floodway that's actually going down the street.
Oh, yeah, we do. If you look at the map,
right through the,
you'll see that blue hatched area.
This is, yeah, we have as the floodplain.
And then south.
All I mean, the way is any of it currently developed?
Yes.
Well, right, you have, well, it's platted right in here. You just have sections that are platted of residential lots, but very small portions of those lots.
But this area down below?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Right,
well, that's floodplain.
Yeah,
it's floodway. My question is actually fairly specific. Floodway, do we have any developed floodway land? Floodway land. And there's a big difference between a floodway and a floodplain. That's what I'm
asking.
Just
where James is pointing.
It's up there.
Where the river goes through the town. This is floodplain, but see the thread of the river actually is outside, except for right here. And so,
that's it.
But here you have platted lots that are legal lots, but if they were to be developed, they'd have to comply with the floodplain requirements. But even then, there's other issues regarding
which way.
I got an area.
Floodway, they're in the water right now.
Huh?
They're underwater right now. So they're
no, there's actually towns, including Matters, have
that
flood. The floodway actually goes through town, and you cannot build a building there. So that's why I'm asking.
Canals, covered, or not.
So it's not like you don't have any.
Well, floodway is something that basically floods every year. It's the high water mark type of issue. And floodplain is something that it's a 100-year.
Sure. No, I got it.
Yeah.
On page 48 is a very important chart for people who wish to develop inside the city or want to know more about what the development requirements are. It describes by zone the minimum lot widths, setbacks, minimum side yards, rear yards, structure height, and maximum lot coverage. And when you go through that, you'll see that the residential zones, minimum lot width is 25, and then your basic setbacks, maximum structure height of 45, commercial zone is taller for obvious reasons. And then as you go down, we'll be making those changes to the forest zone and calling out public facilities. And we'll be adding the heights in there so that we don't have an inconsistency with the BioGreen project. So we'll get that new height in there.
Where did these numbers come from?
We worked on these with the Planning Commission. And they're pretty basic. I mean, you think of a single family home, you have to have air and light between the next structure.
Sure.
And, you know, the more dense zones, the more urban zones, you don't need that much setback.
So I'm just assuming that these could be county codes that you just worked over?
I mean,
you got a template somewhere, and
they're different in every community.
Yeah.
Depending upon what the community wants, but a lot of times
we did not copy the county code. This is just for Lapine.
These are based. A lot of, for example, like height limits. A lot of times are based upon typical construction standards. That if you have Now, how tall is a single family home that has two floors and a gabled peaked roof? What is your typical height? You know, people are building 9-foot ceilings these days, so you're, you know, you have the foundation, then you have 9 feet and a foot between that and the next floor, and then, you know, all of a sudden you're at 30 feet. So there are a lot of them are based upon architectural requirements or actual standards, typical construction.
Yeah. I mean, you had like 70 feet in your commercial one, that's actually pretty high for a town this size.
Mm-hmm.
That's high. That's a four-story building.
It is.
Well, and more.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's,
and that would look out of place.
Well, and it's the maximum that a fire department can handle right now. Mm-hmm. So it, we don't go above that except in the industrial zone.
Well, this fire department can't handle a 70.
They don't still have a ladder truck?
Yes, they do.
It's actually higher than it was before the county than we used to be with the county.
Uh-huh. It was shorter. Right. For example, single family part of this is going to be dictated, though. When we work with the Planning Commission, if I back up, it was very good working with the Planning Commission because a lot of times people write zoning codes in terms of thinking about what people shouldn't be able to do with their property, and they thought of this in terms of what people should be able to do with their property and add that flexibility. So when you see, for example, the RMF, and RMP, the residential zones, the maximum height is 45 feet. It's going to be rare that you get a single family residence that's 45 feet. You know, because typically, that would be like a three-story with a gabled, you know, roof home. You just don't get a lot of those. But it's permissive for the multifamily structures. So they didn't want to be that limiting. And the market will dictate a lot of what people end up. You're not going to see a lot of 70-foot
roofs
right away downtown.
Is there anything in here that says something about if you're within X amount of feet of a arterial or a road? You can't be over a certain height, or you have to get a. Well, we're not in anywhere where we're talking about permits yet, are we?
We're getting into that.
We will. Okay.
Yeah, but what you are asking about from the highway, there isn't a specific setback to a structure. It's just based on the zone that abuts the highway.
Yeah, see, it would be nice someday. This is good. And then someday, years from now, when we go to that next stage, it would be nice to have Huntington have its own separate kind of code as a downtown. Where you want them to go, say curb tight. You want your building to come out as a downtown.
Mm-hmm.
You want them to have a minimum height of 20 feet or something. Even if it's a one-story building, it's got to look 20 feet. That's what Sisters, Madras, Downtown, Redmond, all of us have done that.
You do, and eventually.
But for starting here, it's fine. But you wouldn't do that on 97 because you're going to have gas stations, and hotels, and they tend to be back because it's auto dependent. But when you get on Huntington and you want to start to create a downtown that has two story buildings and they built out to the sidewalks, like you see in a traditional downtown bin.
Sure.
See, we don't have that right now. Right now, you tend to have parking lots and then the buildings. But over time, you would want to transition Huntington.
So you can do that with this code.
Mm-hmm. You can. You'd add a current chapter.
Yeah, right. Yep. But it's not in here now.
No, it's not there now. And I mean, when you do that, you're also probably going to get into design standards.
Right.
What
exactly.
You want the buildings to look like. Yeah. You need to have a certain amount of windows and awnings and things that you create that downtown feel.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, when people come into town to do development, we would require them to submit a site plan.
Can I step in for 1 second, real quick? I just want to, when you look at that section that has all the yard and height requirements, and then you go back to, like, for example, you don't need to look back there, the section that has all the uses. I think when people come to town, like Deborah's going to say, I think what you'll end up doing when you administer your own code, and the way we design this code is, you can pull this page out, you can pull a couple pages out of the code right here, hand it to people, and they'll be able to look at it and know exactly what they can and can't do on a certain piece of property as it's zoned, be able to know what the development requirements will be without having to pull the entirety. And there'll be other things like parking requirements that you'll see you'll be able to pull out, put them together, and hand it to property owners.
Okay. Yeah, those quickie sheets were something that the City Planning Commission really wanted to have.
Yep.
So back to site plan. It's very logical. developers need to tell the city what they're doing, and they need to draw it on a piece of paper so that we can tell what they're doing to scale. So they will show us their structures, the setbacks, where they're located, the zone, landscaping, connections to public utilities, all the information that would be necessary to make sure that their development is consistent with the city's code. I'm not going to go through each provision, but it's very logical, just like I described. And these are the typical things that we'll ask people to do. If somebody's just coming in to do a garage addition to their house, obviously their site plan is less complex. But if somebody's coming in to do a new shopping center, it has to have more complexity. When a conditional use is required on page 59, there's a process and there are criteria. Tests that the developer...
So, I didn't see... does it talk about partitioning lots or anything?
In the subdivision.
Okay.
Yeah, that's in... It'll be in the land division code. We have subdivisions, partitions, and... Yep.
So, in conditional uses, there are little tests or requirements that have to be met to determine whether the conditional use can be approved or denied. And you'll see they start on page 59. And A, B, C, D, and E all have to be addressed by the applicant in order to achieve approval. And there's other conditions that are listed down below as well.
So what will happen is they will have to submit a site plan review application showing all of those items so we physically know how it's going to be developed. But if it's conditional use listed as conditional use, they also have to tell how and why they meet these five criteria right here. They have to demonstrate on their plan that, you know, they meet these criteria and submit a written document just saying how and why. So it's a little bit, you get a little bit, it's so that you get a little bit more information to know how their use is going to impact that area in which they are. Because again, conditional uses are something that they're allowed, but they may have some impacts that are over and above what you typically see in that zone.
And guidance is given on how far the Planning Commission or City Council should go in determining impacts and mitigation when a conditional use is applied for. So under 3.0, General Conditions on page 60, you'll see some boundaries that are set that allow the Planning Commission or City Council to impose additional conditions in order to make sure that the conditional use is appropriate.
Is this where they would, where you would address the fact that Sam Smith goes through this process, he starts a business, he sells it to Fred Jones, and Jones changes the business, which doesn't comply with the conditional use permit, and he has to reestablish that with the city, and on the condition of sale, or we talked about that one time. I remember.
Yeah, we did, and some of the issues you're talking about are more like non-conforming uses, uses that have been established for a while, whether they're meet this code or not. What will happen is if you have something that doesn't fit in the zone that we've set for it, it will become a non-conforming use. It's recognized as a use that's there, but if you expand it, there'll be limitations on how you do that, but it isn't connected with sale.
Well, I'm really talking about new business.
Yeah.
New business that comes in, you know, the two conditions, I mean, we went through this whole process, and then he sold the business 5 years later. And somebody else bought it and actually decided to really change his focus, and he moved that into a different
use
that doesn't...
If it wasn't a principal use that's allowed and it was
conditional use,
yeah, then he'd need to apply.
Well, they would have to comply with the provisions of that previous conditional use approval for the property, and if it changed substantially, they come back through the process.
I guess really what I'm focusing on here is, so you get a new owner, he changes all this, and how does the city know? Until they finally get a complaint from the next door neighbor.
Like, you know, I think what triggers it, and you guys attempted to do this a couple years ago, is a business license. And you know, part of the reason that you want a business license is, even if it's $20, it forces everyone to come in and tell you what they're doing. And so you have it in a data file. And so if a guy takes over a retail store and then he says, well, I'm going to open up Jim's body shop and I'm going to paint cars, then you say, uh-oh, you can't paint cars in that zone. See, because we don't have a business license, they can sneak in a little. It's a small enough town, and with the people that I notice running around town, there'll be lots of inspectors.
There's another way. I think that would help is a lot of times people transfer the usage of sewer and water.
Yeah.
So when somebody comes in for a new water hookup, you'll see a name change, or you'll know that the use has changed.
Yeah, they do sneak in. You know where they sneak in is strip malls and things.
Yeah.
But generally, they're still retail in nature. But that's what the... But you were... One thing... on a non-conforming use, do you allow a year if it's vacant for a year?
No.
Because that'll bite some
folks. And that's in here.
Yeah.
And there's other... there's a variety of ways. You can... When you get the decision and it lists the conditions of approval that somebody has to comply with, you know, sometimes you require those conditions of approval to before they can begin operating to be recorded against the property, meaning their restriction, like CC&Rs or another form, their city imposed CC&Rs that if you're going to operate this business, you have to do it in this fashion, so that when you buy the property and you get the title report, you don't have any argument to say that you didn't know because right. You get that. You
and how is that implemented?
Through the one of the conditions of approval will be all these other conditions of approval need to be recorded against the property before we issue you a building permit. Show us that put the county recorders on there. So,
and then it shows up on title.
Yeah.
So in addition to conditional uses, you have variances, similar uses, and exceptions. Variances are typically a stronger way to change the code to do what you want. You'll notice that it takes achievement of these different conditions in order to get the variance. And I'll give you an example. The setback is 10 feet, but the way you want to design your property, you can't meet the setback of 10 feet. You want 9.5. So you have to apply for a variance. It's not a conditional use, but it's something that requires a variance process or some kind of process to allow that setback to be modified. So we have sections in here that give you the tools to grant variances, to look at similar uses.
Ken, you should be looking ahead to page 66 just so that you're plotting and ready. Just while the rest of us work on 63 and 64.
What? Okay.
No, I got mine instead.
Okay. So, any questions on variances, conditional uses, similar uses? Sometimes you've got uses that aren't listed, but they're very similar, so you have to have a ruling on that. Okay, are we moving on to chickens?
We want them while we're fresh.
Okay.
Well, the eggs are fresh.
All right, page 66. I'm skipping a few things that are kind of dull and boring, but we can come back to those. Animal raising, care, and processing. We had a long discussion about this at the Planning Commission level. And one of the things Rick brought up was a complaint about manure, too much manure in somebody's yard because they had overstocked it with horses.
Right.
And it was a disaster. And then after the snow, the manure would flood onto the neighbor's property, causing just terrible havoc. So that brought up, okay, how many horses, how much livestock should be allowed? You'll see in 701.4 on page 66 what the Planning Commission felt was appropriate. But we've heard from the City Council that they'd like to be more flexible with chickens.
Heard from one person on the City Council we'd like to be more...
Yeah, but I saw a shaking of heads.
Oh, okay.
So I'll count that as more than one. So we should talk about that because the mayor has suggested some language that allows... a special section for fowl raising, care, and processing. On a half an acre, you can have no more than 12 egg-laying fowl, fertile fowl. And that I checked on this. There's actually a website dedicated to chicken laws. And
there is.
And this is not...
This probably comes up everywhere.
It does. And it's not unusual. It's a good idea. Yeah. What you want to be careful of is how close the hen house is to another home. And so we have to have a decent setback, and you've done that. No more than 15 feet.
So what sections are we changing here? You have a paragraph to come in.
Yeah, we can pull in a section on fowl based on what the mayor has drafted.
And then pull out the fowl out of this?
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. Well, I rewrote the whole section. If you look at the sections you have a copy of that I provided, the 701-4 was rewritten to a form that would speak to the two horses, two something other, and accommodate it as the basic language that we would replace here.
Okay.
And then on I used 701-4A as chickens, and then you didn't get this, but I got to thinking about what am I going to do about those 15 rabbits I got in my yard.
Do rabbits, what does they do to count?
So I wrote 701.4B.
And you'll get that to me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just email it to me.
Yeah.
How many rabbits are you allowing?
Well, what does it say, Adele?
Zero.
12 rabbits.
12 rabbits, okay. Yeah.
For
half
acre.
So you
get 24 if you have an acre.
Holy smokes.
That is...
Should you put a maximum number of rabbits?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you had 10 acres, would you put a maximum on that?
One thing, too.
240 rabbits.
Yeah, and we have the setback, so they can't be in your
wide choice. Hands or rabbit hands or whatever.
It's all
yeah,
okay. That's for the first
week. Being closer than 15 feet to a residence.
They multiply.
Okay, but are we still okay on horses? I want to make sure the public that came forward about the horses, you can only
have two per acre,
and we're all good with that.
That's exactly how it's written there, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm good.
And then that includes cattle, llamas, goats, alpacas, sheep, and pigs, and similar species, but we'll have something separate for rabbits.
Someone was trying to make it, but if you have 4-H, you're exempt, but I didn't see it.
Well, it's online here. Okay. You will see, because we have a large 4-H contingent here, and how I wrote it on that was...
Let me just talk really long. My only concern, I'll throw out to you guys, is all you have to do is have a 10-year-old in your house, and they go sign up for the 4-H club, and now I can have 6 horses on my half acre. Just be careful of that, because the family that had the 8 horses, they had 4-H kids. Now, they weren't 4-H projects, but without getting into a bunch of detail, but the way you're reading it is just... It has to be a 4-H. Yeah. You belong to a 4-H organization, so all you have to do is sign up, never attend, and then you have unlimited.
Yeah.
And, I think the argument on the other side would be, if when it comes to a horse, inside the city limits, 2 is all you get.
Okay. Let me speak to that. You're absolutely right. I know of a situation that speaks to just what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very aware, and that's an interesting thing that we should be very considerate of. Then you get down to smaller things like pigs, and each 4-H, and I don't know if you have it here, because what I wrote was this requirement shall exclude 4-H animals where property occupants are members of a sanctioned 4-H organization. That's some kind of language that puts limits about them being 4-H.
You could put a time, you could put something like a season, because one thing about a 4-H pig or a lamb...
Per season.
They show up, someone would get you that, but say they start January and they're gone by August 31st, so it's just not a year-round animal. Yeah.
We can try it. It's a toughie to enforce. And let's get some experience with it, because I think what you're going to find is there'll be some abuse, but as time goes on, you can refine this language.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about places like this over here between 1st Street and the other side of 6th Street, where this is all pasture land, there's no homes, and horses graze out there, and there aren't any homes.
But you're dealing with two horses per acre.
Yeah, still two per acre.
I mean, if that's a 20-acre lot, then...
Right, that was my question. Yeah. I mean, you know, there aren't any homes or anything. Could there be an exception to have, since there aren't any homes, you actually have more acreage, more room per acre?
Two is still probably okay, I think they were saying. If you had 10 acres, you'd have more than 20 horses on it.
Would you think so?
Yeah. But the limit would be two, so
an exception.
The cumulative would be 20, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
I think this just gives the city the option to enforce this. I mean, you can write all these ordinances you want, but if you have no enforcement, then you have nothing.
I think I see a hand or two, but I'm concerned about there's going to be public comment later. Anybody got a problem with somebody no more than we have in here that, like Wayne has a question?
It's your Mayor, it's your discretion.
Yeah, Wayne.
I was just curious about my Great Dane puppy mill that I'm going to be starting as my new business in my residential property. And I'm not sure whether I've got a half an acre. How many Great Dane puppies can I have? Is this addressed in the livestock issue, or does this go to more horses?
If you'll first figure out what zone you're in, I'm assuming a residential zone.
Residential.
And then if kennels are allowed, you could have it. If they're not allowed, you can't.
Because kennels are called out separately.
So it is spelled, out?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. Because I don't want a Great Dane puppy.
I also have an animal control ordinance, and as an option, I can do that.
Okay, so let's move on, and let's understand that...
Oh, yes.
Well, I think there's got to be a breakdown between your large and small animals. And then, if it's small animals, I don't think it's numbers of acres. I think it's distance to your neighbor's house or something like that, because just, you know, having a half acre or an acre, you may not have a neighbor for five lots. And if there's nobody there, they're not going to be a nuisance. And that's what it comes down to. Is it a problem? I mean, it's, you know, you want to have some standards, but if you live on a half acre and there's five half acre lots, then why couldn't you have 20 chickens? You know, it's not going to bother anybody.
Well, there's a couple things. One thing that we put into the code talks about pens, runs, and the separation from side yard setbacks.
From lawn lots.
And that way the city has less enforcement, because instead of looking at vacant land as a way to expand the operation, everybody has their lot. Mm-hmm. They must work within that lot. It makes it easier for the city to enforce.
Well, and that's fine, but I mean, rather than saying a half acre or an acre or something, why don't we say distance to the property line or something like that? I mean, like in Gilcrest, which is not a city, but it's a neighborhood with 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 square foot lots. People up there have cows, they have chickens, and they get along just fine. And people don't even know they're there, you know. So I know that it can be done without problems, and I just hate to be more restrictive than we need to be.
The only thing about that is you have Crescent Creek, which each one of those homes then could have 12 chickens.
It doesn't make sense. It's two.
And two horses. You didn't limit it.
Well, I think the large animals, you definitely have to break that out. But there is a small animal, large animal, and most codes separate that out.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, can I ask you a question real quick? Do I understand this right, that this will not go back to planning commission after this meeting?
No, not in this process. There will be a public hearing next for the city council where testimony can be taken, and if there's something that individual planning commissioners feel strongly about, send the letter, let me know, because this is the time where we can make adjustments. If it's something minor and inconsequential, we can change that.
And then there's public comments. I'll save that.
And it's like, you don't want to keep going back and amending your code, but sometimes there's certain sections of the code that are hard to figure out. And once you put something into practice, you'll soon start to figure out what needs to be amended. And you can always go back and change the code. You don't want to keep doing it, but certain things you will have to change the code. And then it goes back to the Planning Commission first to work on, and then comes back before the City Council. So I mean,
we'll never get one adopted otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
If I may, maybe I will make a comment now then, because I would really like to put the animal issue to rest, because this code is a huge code. And with all due respect to the mayor, I understand this is important, but
there's much more to do with this. It's to me, it's much more easier to start out with a little more restrictive of a code to do with animals, and then later add a couple more chickens. It looks like the city is really helping. If we set a lot, to set a large amount and then try to subtract that in the future is very negative on the public relations for the city. It's much easier to give them a gift later on as we go on. I everywhere else in the state of Oregon, it has a maximum of 6 chickens. I really want to give Ken 12 chickens. I really do. But we really need to look what is best for the city of Lapine. That's all I have to say about that.
Okay, we'll move along then.
Okay, we'll blend what has been presented, and at the public hearing, we'll take another look at
we'll
it, make sure it's what you want.
We're going to
blend.
Not sure what we're going to get.
Yeah. And my comment in regards to this, I think that I would tend to go with recommendation of the of the Planning Commission, who have spent a lot of time, and I do remember a lot of time being spent on this animal issue. So
you're staking the 4?
Well, the way it exists now.
4 chickens.
The recommendation?
Yeah, the recommendation.
Which is 2?
No, that's 4 chickens.
7014.
Number 2 says 4 chicken hens.
Which permitted to the number 4 where it says.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Getting distance.
Yeah.
Or operation.
Okay.
And just, you know, as I know that Gloria and John have both given up so much of their time to be on the Planning Commission. And, you know, I just. My idea would be it'd have to be really something egregious to go to not take a recommendation from a volunteer committee.
We actually negotiated and wanted to give them some more chickens.
Yeah.
Didn't I say 6 or 8 or something?
Like,
I mean,
yeah. See, my impression when I've been here was that the 4 you weren't going to have heartburn if that number was a little higher.
Right.
So don't get off
this score. Yeah. We did not realize that it was 1 acre either. You know, when we talked about it, we thought that had been changed. So it was, you know.
And that was just for the horses.
No, on the chickens.
On the chickens, okay.
Yeah. In Oregon, and 6 seems to be a maximum. Actually, the city of Bend is 4 chickens, and it's $104 a year annual permit. We don't have any permit structure, neither free nor monetary in there. And that could be addressed in the future too. For control, you would want a permit structure. And then if you're a little greedy like the city of Bend, you charge $100 for 4 chickens.
Let me say some more
in here. One of the things is we're not Bend, you know, we're a unique community. We've got lots of people in this town who raise chickens. I'd be glad to bring you along and show you my hen house. And this number of 12 on a half acre is absolutely not too many. And it is not the truth. There is a lot of exceptions in the state of Oregon where you have more than this number of chickens per half acre. So, and to speak to the other issue about, you know, granted, we could do something and then get down the road and change it. Mm-hmm. But we're here at a point in time. This is something that you're going to hear about, I guarantee you. And I don't think this is egregious. I think this is a very common sense. I've put a lot of thought into it, looked at the property I own and the way other people have theirs built. And this is a middle of the road, common, not common, but a middle of the road approach to a unique town that.
In a situation like this, Mayor Mullenix, what we would do is ask direction from the council. I mean, you've made a great statement, and you've backed it up with your research. At this time, it would be sensible to direct us as a group what you want us to do. Because I could write four, we could write
sure.
four.
Four, six, eight,
two, and four. Let us do that.
Give me some guidance, please.
Okay. Can we start with you, Stu?
Pick a number, Stu.
I mean, I've provided each one of you with a document that you can look at that could be changes, that could be flipped right in. So,
well, first I want to know, before I pick the numbers, how much crap do these things produce?
Exactly. Chickens do not have an extensive crap level.
Okay.
But, because I can take you to my hen house and show you where 10 months and it wouldn't be a wheelbarrow full of crap.
Okay.
Or poop, I mean, you know.
Waste.
I'm sorry to refer to it as that, but waste. That's the best.
That is funny.
Okay. Because you have the chickens, and say someone has cows, and you have llamas, and all this waste. What are you doing with the waste?
You have to get rid of it.
Yeah. Where? Where's the waste going?
That's your problem. You have to get it away. I mean, that's the resident's problem, and it's written in here.
And where does it go?
They have to haul it.
Leading up to somewhere.
Yeah, they have to haul it.
It is against county code for us as a company to pick that up, and it can't go to the transfer
station. We don't tell them the code where to take it.
That's it. You're passing a code that is going to affect something else.
Well, yeah, but how can you? Yeah.
Okay, then I'd have to say two.
Two chickens?
Two chickens.
Are you ready for the next one?
Absolutely.
The next comment, I meant.
Yes.
Please. Having the first job I ever had was cleaning chicken houses. The first job. And I got to 50 cents an hour, and we had a chicken house that was probably half again the size of this room, and he had six of them, and we had to clean them. And I can remember going home and my mother saying, "Don't come near the house till you got out of your clothes." And so I kind of know how chicken waste smells. And you know, on a hot day, if you've got close neighbors, I'm not so sure that it's a good thing to have a lot of waste there. And my concern is pretty much like Stu's. Where is this going to go? I mean, you say it's got to go someplace on somebody else. Is it going to be somebody else's problem when we get rid of it? Even though you say it's the owner's problem, I don't know. I think if you have six chickens at home, that should be adequate, in my personal opinion. That's
half
my
dozen.
Opinion.
Half dozen eggs a day.
Well, I don't eat any more than that.
Six.
The thing about it is, a neighborhood like Crescent Creek or someplace like that can have CCNRs and does, which can set rules and regulations also. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of large lots, a lot of rural places. This is a small town. We want it to be rural feeling. Six chickens don't lay six eggs.
That's right.
And in the winter, they don't lay hardly any. We have chickens. Mike Supkus will take all the chicken poop you can give him and his wife, because they do organic gardening, and they would like the llama poop too. There's lots of people around that are into that kind of thing, and that's not a real major problem. This is a small town. We shouldn't be any more restrictive than what we have to be. I'd like to know how many complaints we've ever had about chickens or cows or horses in this town, because I don't think we've had hardly any.
Horses
is
the one we've
had. You've had complaints in town?
Yes.
Yeah.
In the city?
Yes.
Significant.
Yeah. A lot.
I bet that my biggest complaint pile has been chicken. Excuse me, horses. I've never
had a chicken. What street is that on?
It's all in Cagle, the big lots.
In Cagle?
Yeah.
Okay.
And people, what happens, there's people on all sides complaining, because okay. It's a big, yeah, you said earlier, I mean, it's a big difference between what a cow produces and a horse produces
daily.
Cow or chicken, you mean?
And
No, or a cow, or a horse, and a chicken.
Okay.
And so, you know, I have not had a chicken complaint.
Well, the way I guess, you know, I think we're small enough town. Deborah says we're not going to grow to more than 1,000 people in 20 years. I think we could almost handle any nuisance situation, where if there's a complaint, we handle the complaint as a nuisance and let the market handle it. I just don't think there's going to be that quantity of problem where you have to set it up.
I think you should have a number. I have at least a number, whether it's higher than, but just so that a person doesn't get...
Okay. I just hate to get us into this institutional thing.
And there wasn't anyone trying to, you know, he's only asking for 12.
Well, I know, but some people might, you know, I mean, if you go to his house, you don't know they're there unless you go out there. It's,
And I'm just going to point out one other thing is that oftentimes you can get caught up on the number and you have to look at all of those criteria. So I'm not advocating for any particular number, but regardless of whether you have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, it falls back on you. You have an ability to remedy a bad situation because there are other standards that
sure.
make you responsible
shorters.
So
is the 1 acre still in there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have chicken with under an acre?
Well, no.
The chickens is half acre.
Yeah.
So how many chickens, Dan, do you want on a half acre?
Mine is an acre.
Well, no. Read the one that...
The mayor's recommending.
Oh, I didn't know we were talking about that one. I thought this was just his.
Yeah.
This is...
Well, we're talking about putting that in and having what's in the book.
Okay, I thought that was just your independent.
So instead of 1 acre, it'd be half acre and no more than 12 chickens.
And I would speak to this one thing again, if I could. I didn't think of it earlier, but, you know, you don't get, if you've got 12 chickens, you don't get 12 eggs, I guarantee you, okay? And in the wintertime, that can drop to as few as four or five.
Ours dropped to none.
They especially around here, they go low.
You haven't met my brother's chicken. Want some eggs?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not worried about the number of eggs.
Well, I think James had a good comment here in that if you go down and look at these other six items, you will find that they strengthen the number or the whole idea by speaking to, you can't have a pile over this big, you can't have melodious odors, or, you know.
So between 6 and 12,
mm-hmm.
And in order so we can move on to all of the mini topics, you probably need the right direction.
Okay.
What about, could you say reasonable? And then it meets this criteria here, or we don't put a name.
That requires such interpretation that it'd be a mess.
Right. Our code person we hire is going to be on a contract. There'll be some part time. They need to be able to go count. If you got 20 chickens and we only allow 12, you'd say, look, you got to get rid of 8 or whatever.
Could I make a suggestion, just so that we can move forward and we can bring this up again? Because the maximum discussed today has been 12. Let me put that into the code, and we'll see what the public reacts at the hearing. And if we have to make an adjustment, we can make an adjustment then, if you agree that an adjustment is needed. I'd rather start with the 12. Let's see what response we get. And then if we have to make an adjustment, we can do so at the hearing. That's an easy thing to do. And it gets us kind of onto the next subject.
You know, Mayor and Council, if I may, what you could do, too, is put language in, say, up to a maximum of 12. Fowl. Now, you can't limit it. You can't be
prejudiced
against chickens. You have to say, you have to have ducks in there and stuff.
And he does.
You say up to 12 fowl and put a permit that you must come into the city to get a permit to raise chickens, zero cost. City's great, doing a service and all this stuff. We're actually giving them a service for nothing. Come in, get a permit, up to 12 chickens. And then you have the city control with that then. You have your 12 chickens and all that. Because what you really want is you want control as a city. You've said that over and over again, that you want to control the city, okay? There's your control. Put a permit on it, but up to a maximum of 12 with permit. You go out there with the permit, and you see what kind of facilities they have. If they have 5 acres and they want 12 chickens, fine. Put them on the back 40. If they have a half acre and they want them 10 feet from their neighbor, say no, sorry.
I think at this time that I'd like for us to speak to your
Deborah's
suggestion.
Suggestion.
That sounds good.
Go for it.
That the general shaking of body parts, we can move on.
We have a consensus.
Okay.
Go for it.
So, that will be incorporated for review at the public hearing, and we'll take it from there.
24 grown sticks.
Or into parts. Okay. Campgrounds, there is some standards for that. There was a big concern about junk. And so under 701.7 on the bottom of page 66, we talk about that. Junk dealers, how that has to work with the license fee. This is something where we want a lot of control because we've had problems in the past. I'm not going to go through each of the license requirements.
You define junk.
I do.
Where's that?
In the definitions. God, I hope it's there. Yes, junk dealer, junkyard, and junk. It's a pretty good description. Okay, that's heavily regulated for obvious reasons. If we want to discuss it, let me know. But moving on to sanitary landfills, solid waste, and similar facilities. We have some standards for that, which are really pretty consistent with other communities in that you have to meet state of Oregon law and get your permits there and prove to us that you have those permits. Accessory dwellings, we talked about this a little bit before. This is one of the things that cities have struggled with, often called mother-in-law units or guest quarters. It's really important to be sensitive to the need in the community for people to have an extra unit when they need it. And so what if it's rented out to a college kid? We're at least we're doing density in a way that people want to have it done. It's a good step forward. And so I advocate heavily to allow accessory dwellings and not get caught up in who's in them.
I like this.
Okay. Because we don't want to be enforcing, you know, the insides of homes.
And it's a way, again, when DLCD says there's pressure to create a certain amount of density within your community, which people always equate to small lots or multifamily dwellings, it's a way where you have large lots where you're not really changing the character of the neighborhood and dividing up all those lots, but you're getting density on an existing development path and allowing people flexibility. So
don't put chickens in it, right?
Yeah, no
kidding.
Right.
Actually, they're inside. Okay.
Yeah, not interior chickens. So on page 70, home-based business, quite a bit of discussion about what that is, and we've synthesized that down to 5 conditions. All very sensible. As long as you're not offending the other parts of the neighborhood and you meet these limitations, you'll do fine. Sawmills, we have those specifically permitted. They have their own regulations. Large land area commercial recreation uses. This is something we have to be aware of because in some communities there are facilities that go in and cities have difficulty regulating them. So if it's a water park or some other kind of circus or kids facility, here's what will help you regulate it with the setback standards. Under 702, just a general listing of additional regulations so that we have something to use in enforcement should somebody step out of line from their setbacks or how their business expands on the lot, etc. Take a look at those.
Can we go back to the large area, land area commercial recreation uses?
Yes.
You have in there, am I following this right, that says, yeah, permanent facilities for stock car or other motorized vehicle racing is prohibited?
Yes.
We have such a large piece of public facilities land out here that might be perfect for a stock car track. Can couldn't leave that open as a possible use?
One of the things that... let me think this through.
We have noise control and stuff.
The state was very concerned that we use that land for very limited activities. Large lot industrial, energy production, public facilities, like sewer expansion. And to put in a commercial recreation facility would be completely on the opposite of where they want us to go. There are other good places for that kind of facility, and they're typically outside of UGBs, unless you have a huge...
Not the county, Deschutes County doesn't encourage that very much.
Well, it may be something, you know, when it comes forward, it's going to be better suited in the county where noise can be buffered better than inside an urban area where sometimes those things conflict over time. And those kinds of things are very difficult to place inside a UGB, and then as the city grows up around it, all of a sudden it becomes the problem. So we typically try to keep them outside of UGBs.
Things like that, I guess it's kind of back to the some of the chicken discussion. It's easier right now to regulate against them, and it's going to be a rarity.
I'm just looking for economic development.
Yeah, then you get, but I think if you get a proposal like that, somebody will come talk to the council and say, I found a spot.
Okay, I have somebody on the table right now, so that's
fine.
Yes.
I think there are things where you can look at a site-specific area.
Well, the county doesn't seem to be very excited about it, and I thought with this open land out here, it might be an opportunity for La Pine to do some stuff.
How many acres would you need?
I think they need about 80 acres.
80
to
acres.
Do it right. It's a big NASCAR-type track.
And the noise decibels, do you have that?
I think it's 85 or 88 or something like that. I can't remember. I'd have to double-check on that.
Almost twice the biomass plant. That's a tough one. Can you let us look into it a little bit?
Yeah.
And see what other communities have done so that we've got some good data.
Everybody has fairgrounds and stuff. They do this kind of thing, and they're usually inside city limits. Quite often they are, but...
Let us look at that, because...
I'll tell you, speaking of a little experience with tracks like that, in Petaluma, California, my daughter and son-in-law live right across... the interstate highway from the fairgrounds, and the fairgrounds has stock car racing every Saturday night, and for a half a mile or more each way, the noise is deafening. Yeah. You can't sleep, you can't do anything. I mean, it is horrible, and I would vote against any stock car racing inside the city limits. I mean, that's just my feelings on it from the experience that I've had.
Yeah, that's similar to my experience too, but to be fair and balanced, I'll collect some data, we'll take a look at it, and bring back how other communities have dealt with the issue. We don't want to be against economic development, but there are certain levels of compatibility that we should look at too.
What noise level can they get it down to?
Well, if it's above 80, that's... you know, twice the BioGreen plants, to put it in perspective.
It's electric car racing, hybrid car racing.
Oh, God.
There you go.
Okay.
You're not allowed to run around.
All right, we're almost done, and then we can have a break. On pages 71, we start with additional regulations that refine the basics within the code. So we have additional commercial zone buffer and screening requirements, additional regulations for the industrial and light industrial zone, more detailed data. And then we have on page 73 buffering and screening requirements. Buffer strips, the things that were very important for making sure things were compatible. Let's see, mineral excavation regulations, terribly boring, but we have to put it in because there is a potential along the UGB for that. And then the biggie, cell towers, wireless telecommunication facilities, page 75. One thing that you need to know, and you've probably, if you've read the papers recently, the technology is changing dramatically. Instead of towers, we're going to have hockey pucks. And they'll be on buildings, they'll be unobtrusive, you just won't have the big towers anymore. But for now, we have to put something in. So this section provides regulations for cell towers and ham operators. So we've covered all the potential antenna. Okay. On page 77, we talk about supplementary regulations for temporary mobile homes. Sometimes that has to happen. House is burned down, they need a unit, construction site needs to be needs to have an office, the temporary office. And so we have some regulations there for temporary mobile home placement.
I have a question on the, okay. On the this tower thing, the 707.4.
Yes.
Number two. So how come, is that a usual practice?
Co-location? Yes.
Well, of only on city and county lands?
It's not uncommon. When city or counties allow cell towers to go on their properties, instead of propagating the number of towers, it makes sense and it's usual to co-locate the antenna. City of Bend does it, so that you have several service providers and you're not blotting the sky with one antenna per tower.
Yeah, but they don't restrict it just to
city.
Public, yeah, to public property. They have, there's a ton of devices on private property.
And this particular recommendation is just for city or county property. If you want to expand it, we should talk about that. So I think what you're saying, Adele, is that don't restrict it to city or county. Make co-location.
I agree with that.
A requirement.
Yeah.
Okay.
You could still require it, you know, a permit or, you know, to know.
Well, they would have to go to some sort of land use issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
They'd come to us for the...
I will double check the FCC regulations to see if the federal government allows us to make that mandate on private towers. I'll just double check that. But from what I hear, you're saying it makes sense to collate as much as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. What was it before? Let's see. Yeah, I was going to wonder if we need to talk about height. That's pretty typical stuff. Parking standards. We might as well jump there on page 80. We have parking stall dimensions so that every person in town, including developers, knows what kind of parking they can develop from 0 degrees all the way to 90 degrees. And something just... There's a alarm going off. I guess our time's up. and then based on the uses, we have spaces, for example, hotels and motels, one space for each guest room. Pretty standard stuff. We had quite a bit of discussion over offices, and you'll see that fast food drive-in restaurants have quite a bit of parking required, obviously because they have such heavy usage.
Is there a handicap thing in here?
That's regulated by the building code.
Per business?
Yeah, per number of uses and access points.
Okay.
Per number of space, sorry.
Going back to page 79, this off-street parking and loading, I've been reading some things about what's happening in Bend because the streets are so narrow up there that one guy is parking even one set of tires on the sidewalk to unload. Are we addressing that to the point that we're not going to get in trouble if somebody parks in the street, double parks in the street and starts to unload?
A lot of the park, well, are you talking parking, like just parking the car, my car on the street, or
no, I'm talking about
loading?
You have a business sitting there.
Okay.
You've got 10 parking spots in front of your business, and I'm delivering something to you, and I pull up in the traffic lane and stop. Are the streets going to be wide enough so somebody can get around me, or are they not?
Typically, they're not. designed, I mean, if you're, and downtown situation is where that becomes, where you have the problem. Because again, like some of the design standards we were talking about earlier, is unless you have alleys, which are constructed, you know, that's where you do your loading. Otherwise, you know, like in most of the downtowns, there aren't, what you'll find, for example, if you go to Portland, you'll see a bunch of parking spaces on the street, then you'll see that one sign that says no parking here between certain times of the day, because it's a loading zone.
Yeah.
And it displaces parking in your downtown. That's one way to do it. Typically, you're not going to build these really big, wide streets to let somebody double park. It's a big expense. And
it's a traffic issue and not a parking issue. It's a traffic violation thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
but the point is, are we making provisions so that there's areas that they can?
Yes. For example, a commercial development will submit a site plan showing where their loading space is. Okay. So it's off the street. That doesn't mean FedEx is going to drive you nuts when they block the driveway.
Oh, well, I understand that.
Yeah. Okay. Nonconformities, page 82. It gives you all the standards to recognize existing uses that don't meet the code and what you can do once that structure exists at the effective date of the ordinance. And you might want to take a second to run through that.
This was a section that there was a lot of discussion with the Planning Commission. And overall, you have non-conforming uses of property and structures. You have non-conforming structures and how they're designed and non-conforming lots. And the intent was to allow people to continue to do what they've been doing on your property as long as they don't disrupt it or want to change it drastically, at which point you look at the underlying zone, what is the intent for that zone, and to bring people into compliance. But to acknowledge that if they keep doing the same thing for the next 20 years, they can keep doing the same thing for the next 20 years. And then there's thresholds on how much they're allowed to change. Sometimes people have non-conforming businesses that they've been operating that now aren't allowed in the zone or aren't allowed in the size or design that they're allowed in that zone, but their business is growing. You don't want to limit their ability to do more business. So there's thresholds for that as well, allow people to be successful.
That makes sense. And that, it was a healthy discussion with the Planning Commission because they wanted to recognize things that already exist and not create too much of a disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of this document, you have the basic, you've got to pay fees for certain things, enforcement notices, and then prosecution, so that we have consistent enforcement, and then the effective date. These are all standard inclusions for these kinds of ordinances. And I'd recommend we take a 5-minute break.
Okay. We should have zoning.
We're done with zoning.
We're going to go until 8 o'clock, and then we're going to offer offer everybody a chance to go home and look at scheduling an hour before our next council meeting for Kevin and James to come back.
Okay. One thing we'd like to point out is procedures. You can review that on your own. It's just the steps for permit processing. I don't think we have to read it. Everyone would be bored to death. The same thing with SDC mitigation. Take a look at that policy. But I think for now we ought to have James jump in the land division.
Let's see
if we can save some time for signage.
And I'm going to go through this pretty quick because the land division code, there's a couple things that you really want to pay attention to. A lot of this comes from Oregon statutes. It's Oregon Revised Statute 92, Chapter 92 and 227. You can see it right in the purpose statement, right on the front page. And the state is very good at regulating how you divide land, and they provide you definitions. A subdivision is when you divide a single piece of land into four or more smaller properties. A partition, you know, these are the definitions, is when you divide one into either two or three properties. And then there are lot line adjustments where you're just not coming out with any greater number of lots. You're just adjusting the line to make properties larger or smaller. Now, this is a code that works hand-in-hand with your zoning code, where you have minimum and maximum lot sizes, things like that. These are the procedures that you go through to divide property and make sure that when you divide property, when you create a subdivision or partition, that it has all of the physical infrastructure necessary to serve the resulting development and impacts from the development on those properties. So, you know, if you create a 50-lot subdivision, this is going to tell you, okay, that you need to build lots or create lot sizes that are to meet the lot size requirements of the that are specified in the zoning code, that those lots are large enough that you can build a typical house on those that would meet all the setbacks as specified in the zoning code, and that when you build that subdivision, that you put in all of the other amenities necessary to support development, which are water, sewer, all your utilities, and that you have streets, curbs, sidewalks, everything that is deemed necessary for the build-out and livability of that neighborhood. The same thing is true, you know, I think of it because typically it's a lot of, you know, it's residential land is what you have the most of, and that's what you're seeing as residential. But it also applies to, you know, if you have commercial property and you're creating commercial lots. You still, what you're doing is you're regulating the size is adequate for the use and that the infrastructure is in place to mitigate the impacts or to take care of the impacts from the resulting development. So, again, to stay on your 8 o'clock timeline, I'm going to go to...
What's the code and the procedures?
I mean the land division code.
Okay.
Yeah, the land division code. Okay. And if we just look at page 1, which is subdivisions applications, essentially, this is similar to the site plan review section that you looked at in the zoning ordinance. If you submit an application for a subdivision, you need to ensure that all of these elements that are stated in the plan are stated in this document, or shown on the land division plan that you submit. And it's about 5, 6, 7 pages of items that you have to show. And again, you may look at this and say, that's a lot of information that somebody needs to submit. Well, a lot of this, again, comes straight out of the state statute. Some of this you have no choice but to adopt because the state says this is what you need to show and this is what you need to prepare for. The basis is so that you want all of this so that when I go in and I buy one of the lots that have been created, you have a basis to say that you approved a subdivision that had all of the infrastructure for me to build a house and that it wasn't going to overtax or over, not tax in the monetary sense, but overburden your ability to provide water and sewer and street capacity. Not only to this subdivision, but you don't do it to the detriment of other existing development in your community. A case in point is about 10 years ago, there was a private water system in the city of Bend, and the development occurred that basically hooked up new homes and new lots to the water and sewer system, this private water system, at the detriment to everybody. Water pressures went down, capacity to provide, those services went down. So what this is saying is you want the developer, the applicant, to tell me how are the existing systems going to be impacted, and if, through the engineer studies, if they're going to be impacted in a derogatory manner where it affects other parts of the town, they are responsible to do the improvements to serve their subdivision and to maintain the level of service elsewhere in your community. And so that is basically in the first 8 pages are the requirements that you need to submit to show that you will meet your obligations to not impact, overburden facilities. On page 8, you have section 4, planned unit developments. Planned unit developments are a subdivision of land, but they allow a little bit more flexibility. Planned unit developments are, trying to think of...
Crescent Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Clubhouse.
Yeah, it's not your typical, what we often referred to as a city standard subdivision.
A subdivision would be the one back here. That's a subdivision, Crescent Creek.
A lot of times in a subdivision, just a city standard subdivision, once the plat is recorded, the lots are created, and all the streets are created, and those streets become public property, owned by and under the jurisdiction of and responsibility for maintenance, etc., of the city. Oftentimes in a PUD, there's a little bit more flexibility that's allowed, but what happens is you will get some recreational amenities such as trails, parks, it can be a variety of things as listed in there, but you get private ownership of the streets, meaning that a homeowners association has to be established, and there have to be bylaws and CCNRs as to how all of those private amenities are going to be maintained. So with the city's responsibility here, says those are a desirable type of development.
Is it required there, private road?
You can dedicate those. Okay. The city would have to, but there are. But typically, in the PUD, you have.
Because the county, common took, county took the roads in Crescent Creek.
Well, you can have, if you're proposing common area, I guess common ownership for like the recreational amenities. A lot of times, developers will propose common. That the roads be in common areas, so they're owned by and managed by the association. So all of the owners of property within the development have an interest in ownership of all of the common area, all of the common facilities. So that's where, you know, unlike in a city standard subdivision, your tax dollars go toward maintenance and construction and upkeep of those public facilities in general, depending on where you, the council, want to spend it that year. But here, your dollars, you pay homeowners association fees for upkeep of those things. So, you know, in those instances, you make sure that they're designed, the infrastructure there is adequate for the impact that's going to generate from that development in the future. But you also, for example, if a year down the road something fails, a street cracks or breaks, that's the responsibility of the owners association. So if you get a phone call and somebody says, hey, my street's crumbling, you can say, you know, we made sure that it was built appropriately, it met a warranty period, and now it's the responsibility of the homeowners association. Call your homeowners association to fix it.
One thing about the difference between this and a subdivision then would be like sidewalks, because like Crescent Creek has no sidewalks, but it has a trail
system. Yeah.
Correct. Because in the other city standard subdivision, when we get to the end of here, there are specific design standards that if we, the city, are going to accept this, there's certain road widths, curb sizes, sidewalks, and locations, and this is a standard that's going to be the same all over the community. And if you want something different, then you're going to maintain it. So you're still making sure that in a planned unit development subdivision that people still have the ability to walk around throughout the neighborhood, they have the ability to drive around, and that all those amenities are safe. It's just they're doing it in a fashion that's different from what the city says we want to have as the norm and we're willing to maintain and accept. And your freedom to do that is also going to come with the obligation that you maintain it and you pay for it.
Right, and that, so, great. Is this a neighborhood that has failed over Crescent Creek, or Huntington Meadows, I'm sorry.
Is it a neighborhood that's failed?
Yeah. Didn't that subdivision go in with the county as a planned unit development?
No. Right out. It looks pretty cookie cutter. House right next to each other with no amenities.
But the sidewalks failed. Didn't a developer go in and...
The developers always put them in. Maybe there was no one that inspected them very good or something, but it is just a subdivision.
Okay, which is now under the city.
That's correct. Yep.
So the cracked sidewalks that are out there.
Well, in most plans, the sidewalks are actually the responsibility of the landowner, but I don't know if that's the case.
Yes.
Is that?
Yep.
So that's something you'll be putting into your city code eventually.
But right now, those folks have no one to go to.
No, if they're yours up, the warranty's up, the developer's gone.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it would
it's
be
kind of like buyer beware on that. It's, you know, you bought from who you bought from.
Right. But they come to the city, know what to do.
Well, yeah, they will.
Because everyone skipped out on it.
Right. And, you know, the city, would really, those people need to replace them themselves. I mean, it's a call of the council. If the council wants to go spend 50 grand redoing sidewalks over there, they can.
No.
And you'll get that request as the city grows. I mean, I heard it from people come to the city council. It's the same as fix the potholes everywhere. You know, we want those fixed. And you know, and you figure out we have this many dollars and these priorities. And you know that.
I like Crescent Creek. The county owns the high or the roads there, and the county wants us to take them over, and the roads need to be maintained. I mean, we need some work done over there.
So on page 11, we move into section 6, which is land partitions, and that's the third type of development. And partitions are really just small. It's when you have one piece, like I said, and you want to divide it into two or three pieces, no more than three pieces resulting from the one that you have. And a partition is something that typically you don't require. It doesn't require new streets. It's a long and existing street. You're just dividing a piece of property once or twice. So you're not creating a lot of impact to the existing facilities and infrastructure of the community. So oftentimes it's hard to justify, even if the street is substandard, doesn't meet standards that you have in your ordinance, somebody is doing a partition to create just, you know, two lots out of one to improve the whole street section. And the only thing you really require is that those new lots that are developed, that they meet the minimum lot sizes for whatever the use is that's intended by the zone, and that they have water, sewer, and utilities that are extended to those. So it's an easy way. You know, a lot of people that, you know, they may own an acre, 2 acres, and maybe the minimum lot size is 10,000 square feet. I'm just using an example. So they would have the ability at some point in their life to divide off two 10,000 square foot parcels, retain their 20,000 square feet over here with their house, and sell them off and make some money, but not really cause a great big impact like a 40 or 80 or 100 lot subdivision where you're building new roads. So it's just real small scale land divisions. And again, you know, as you go to subsequent pages, it's telling you if you're going to create a partition, here are the requirements. Here's what you have to show on your application, on your plan, and here are the things we're checking for. And the burden of proof or the obligations to do a partition are far less than a subdivision because you're just not creating as much impact. Maybe that I should make that point. Everything that you see in here, when you divide a piece of property, it creates the potential for additional impacts to come from that land. If I had a 40-acre piece of property that was zoned RS, single-family residential, and I had one house on it, I'm creating only a certain degree of impact from that one house. If I divide that 40 acres into, you know, 400 lots, I have a big responsibility as a developer to make sure the infrastructure is adequate. So basically what you're doing is you're looking at, is the infrastructure adequate to mitigate any impacts from the resulting development that could occur as you make the property smaller?
So on your minor partition, where we have 50 by 100 foot lots, and they partition those, say you have 100 of those lots, and you partition each one of them, then you're saying each one has to have a street or a road.
Well, they have to be, well, there's a lot of requirements in here that you have to maintain access to properties. You have to have certain frontage along the property. But if somebody owned 10 vacant lots along a street, and they were all 100 feet by 200 feet, and the requirements, so you could go down to 50 by 100
is what they're actually
today.
Legal lots, yes.
They're existing today. Something that small, if they're 50 by 100, these are giving me an existing situation. If they're 50 by 100 existing today, so it's a 5,000 square foot lot. You probably, the minimum lot size for that zone, it's probably already lower than or small enough that you can't divide them. You know, so for example, if you had a 10,000 square foot minimum lot size, or a 5,000 square foot minimum lot size in a zone, and you had an 8,000 square foot lot, which was bigger than the minimum lot size, you wouldn't be able to divide it because you couldn't make two resulting 5,000 square foot lots.
Okay.
Okay, is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Okay. If it's not double the minimum lot size, you can't divide it unless you go through a variance. But again, the intent is to mitigate the impacts and minimize impacts on infrastructure serving adjoining properties as well as the impacts to that particular property that's proposed for division. As you get into page 15, again, this stuff's pretty dry. It's not as fun as discussing, you know, how many animals you can have on this property. It's just saying, again, it's saying as you go through, you get your initial approval process, then you go through what's called the final map recordation, and that's the actual sort of outline. So all the lots that you see on that map right there, there are plat drawings that are recorded with the county clerk, and it says here's what you need to do to prepare a plat that is suitable for recordation with the county clerk. And once you record that, then it becomes legal to sell those lots. Until you record that, it's not legal to sell those lots. Now, typically, between what's called the initial plat approval, that's where you tentatively say, we like your design and how you're going to mitigate the impacts for your subdivision or your partition, and then filing the final drawing with the clerk, you have conditions of approval that the developer has to meet before they can file the final plat. So, a 100-lot subdivision, the developer may say, I'm going to build the water and the sewer and the streets in this fashion. You would require that prior to filing the final plat, where you can actually sell those lots, we want you to make sure that you put in the water and sewer and streets so that when I buy a lot in that subdivision, I have the ability to build a house and connect it to the water. The water and sewer has been connected to my lot. So you kind of have that stopgap that before you file that final plat, you can make sure that all the infrastructure has put in.
I remember that there was some discussion on the submittal of plans and that we were going to go to an electronic
submission.
Yeah. Submission, go to like immediately go to e-plans or
we had discussed that, but the Planning Commission had not made a final recommendation about that because of the cost of setting up the software. And we've looked at that briefly. Mm-hmm. As you know, the City of Bend has an electronic submittal process so that instead of dealing with paper plans, it's like a PDF on the computer. And our discussion had led to the point that we needed to start off with the standard approach and then build up once the city had more funds to do that kind of software.
Because I thought that was going to go into like our fast track type of...
I think eventually the city would do that, but the setup for that's pretty expensive.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Well, and you're going to have quite a few years before you get into subdivision.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't made fine. And, you know, there are things to fast track, but based on people that have got subdivisions that aren't surveyed right, the one you're talking about back here, you know, there's places, when you actually think about it, if someone's going to come in here and wants to put in a 50 or 100 lot subdivision, spending some plats one time. You know, because those are going to be sold for the next decade or beyond, and the ramifications affect everyone in town, and that's where you need to do it right. It's just different than a guy trying to open up his restaurant. You're trying to get that corn, you know, he's something like that. I think a subdivision where, you know, really, it's a multi-year, large project. We need to make sure that the sidewalks are done right, and the widths are right, and the easements are right, and the surveys are right. And just because a guy wants to have it all completed in the next 4 weeks, might not happen.
If you approve that stuff without making sure that everything's right, it's back to what you said, what you were just talking about, is you accept some roads and some responsibility that aren't done correctly, then it's your responsibility to maintain those and fix those as a community. And so, you know, the obligation always has to be on the person creating the impact, doing the development, and reaping the benefits thereof. So.
But yeah, separate from what I was
saying. You were trying to do electronic.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think eventually you'll get there and it'll be easier.
I imagine everything will be there.
Yeah.
Soon.
But this just sets up the structure no matter what you do.
So starting on page 16, we have section 9. This is in there, but it's something that doesn't happen. Turn to some, and if you can think of one. The dedication of streets not part of the development. Again, when you file a plat, if it's a regular subdivision, When that's filed, the streets become obligated and dedicated to the public. The public owns those. This section is just saying that if somebody wants to dedicate a street to the public, creation of a street, outside of any land division process, they can do so. It's not often.
And it happens occasionally, yeah, but not very often. The important thing is for the council to determine whether they want to take on the maintenance burden.
Right.
And if you don't want to do that, you don't have to accept it. So it's completely within your power.
The most recent one I know about was with Gordy's truck stop down there. That street that comes out from his truck stop actually dedicated it to the county, and the county had him bring it up to a certain level, and then
you can do that,
yeah,
too.
And then they accepted it. So
yeah. Yeah.
That's here in the last,
yeah,
2 years, last year.
Was it that recent?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, last couple of years.
And it could be a requirement of, for example, of a site plan approval that, yeah, that you, yeah, want them to dedicate that, but there's no land division going on. The next page, page 17, section 10, is where it starts to get kind of fun. And because the early sections that specify what you need to show on your plan drawing, this tells how it has to be designed. So you get into things such as how long are, you know, 10.2.0, how long are your blocks, how long are your block lengths, and what, and this is one of those that you need to look at all the numbers in here carefully. We have a block length no more than 660 feet in length. That's essentially an eighth of a mile. And again, I mean, you're thinking that in a gridded street system because that's a comfortable walking distance rather than creating really long block lengths that don't facilitate people walking and or biking through their neighborhood.
And compatible with section lines.
Correct. And as you go into page 18, there are...
That's a good example of too long of a block that wouldn't be approved.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can't cut from one street to the other without going through someone's yard.
Right. And if they don't let you go through, you might end up walking a mile to get to your neighbor that lives one right behind you, you know, 200 feet.
Yeah.
So
when you think of the things on page 18 and 19, it's like a recipe. Here are the things that are necessary to shape the lots and make sure that they meet state law. So there's a series of things that are required, and then there's some steps for different hearings. But when you get to easements, you're going to see that those kinds of things need to be called out specifically on a plat so that everybody knows where that easement is and you can use that over time. That's really important.
And then at the bottom of page 19, you have a section, land for public purposes. and there's a section there that talks about maybe as a result of the development, the impacts of the development thereof. Sometimes it's for the establishment of parks or other public facilities that you can work with and or require a developer to dedicate some land for public purposes, public facilities. That gets a little tricky sometimes, but a lot of times if you're getting really large development, say a 400 lot subdivision, you may work with the developer and be able to require that they dedicate, you know, an acre or so for a neighborhood park that's utilized by everybody. And so these are things that you don't have right now and under, you know, the county's rules that help to build your community. Streets and other public facilities, it talks about the duties of the developer, the traffic circulation system. And then on page 21 is kind of when we're talking about the city standard subdivision, not a PUD where it's privately owned. This is something that the city, when the plat was recorded, the city would own the lots and own the streets. I'm sorry, own the streets, but not the lots. You have different tiers of streets in your community. There's the arterials, the collectors, then it goes down to the local streets. The arterials would be like Burgess Road, where the local streets then are your neighborhood streets. And what you see in there is what's required for the right-of-way width, and then what's the roadway width. And the right-of-way width is always wider. That's where your property line ends. But you may have what we call, you know, no man's land, just a gravel or dirt or landscaped area between the edge of your lot and where the curb of the street may be. Oftentimes it's a planter strip. That's where the sidewalk is located. And so the right-of-way width is almost always wider than the actually what you see in the street. And the reason why you have it, again, is so that you can have sidewalks, so that you have a place for utilities to be
drainage.
Be buried. Drainage, one thing that we discussed with the Planning Commission is in Lapine versus, say, Madras, for example, curbs can cause a whole different issue in Lapine than they do in Madras during the winter when you're doing snow removal or you're doing drainage. So you try to take those things into consideration.
When you think about roadways in Lapine, we had a huge discussion over the effectiveness of having natural drainage come off the paved section instead of directing it through a curb to a catch basin to some other directed area like a bioswale. Both can be used, but when we had extensive talks with the Planning Commission, it was felt that the county standard, which is no curb, actually helps with snow and melt and runoff better than a curb system, which didn't seem to work very well with heavy snow. So it's something, both are acceptable, but the city's going to have to approve which one is better, particularly in new subdivisions.
Because if you have a curb, what you're doing is you're funneling and channeling the water to essentially like a catch basin that then funnels the water elsewhere to be retained and then disposed of at that location. Without curb, sometimes you have a swale along the side of the road and the snow gets pushed into there, whereas, you know, again, I look at in Madras, you know, it's a far different situation than Lapine during the winter. So sometimes those designs are based upon, gee, we'd like to have curbs for a specific look to our community, but they're not practical from a long-term maintenance situation. I mean, in Lapine, you know, if I think 20 years down the road, you could have curbs and you could end up in the winter, what happens is they get plowed and cracked, you replace them, and you say, we wish we would have never done that. So the next, you know, so the next sections on page 21 and 22 all get at design issues for your streets. They talk about, you know, how big your cul-de-sacs have to be, you know, curves. Most of these get at safety issues. They get at design issues so that the driver and the pedestrian don't have conflicts. And so that, for example, in cul-de-sacs, there's a minimum turnaround radius so the fire truck can get down there and turn around. So these all, without going through all of them, street names, street name signs, street names, they have to be approved too, so that how many streets do you know that start with Pine something or other in Deschutes County or Lapine? They have to be very distinct so that when the fire department or emergency services get called, you know, you always see the fire going up, you don't see the smoke and the flames, but if it's a medical emergency, if they can't find you, there's bad stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's why when you see a lot of these requirements in here, they're based upon safety issues. Now, as you get into page 23, some of these, again, are based upon you don't want conflicts between drivers and pedestrians. Some of these are you want to make provisions to implement things we put in the comprehensive plan and requirements from DLCD requiring you want to have adequate bike lanes so that people can ride their bike and not ride down the middle of the highway and be at risk. Some of them also are design issues. You do have some latitude in some of these as to how you want a neighborhood and how you want a street to look.
It kind of follows through with access management that in terms of delivering public safety, you want to make sure that spacing standards are met and you don't have conflicts with roads that aren't perpendicular to one another or too close to one another where cars are turning and they don't have any control. So on page 24, you've got all those standards.
And basically, the bigger the street, and the higher the speed, and the more volume of traffic that you have, there's wider spacing between the intersecting streets or driveway.
We talked about bonding quite a bit, and you touched on it yourself. What happens after the subdivision is approved and the infrastructure is in place? Who maintains it? And so on page 25, you'll see that when improvements are approved, there are things that are required to be done in terms of inspection, bonds, cash deposits, assurances of improvements, so that the developer's on the hook for the warranty period. And then after that, if it's in good shape, the city can accept it, and it will be part of the city system where the city maintains it in perpetuity. So we talk about that on 25 and 26.
So is review this. It's those last few pages, those design standards, that oftentimes, I mean, the issue was brought up earlier about street widths and bend, is there the ability to have adequate loading area. A lot of times, I'm just throwing this out there for you to think about, is street width can become a very touchy subject. From the developer's perspective, they want to build very narrow streets because building streets and infrastructure is costly. But a lot of times, and some residents want narrower streets because it slows traffic down through their neighborhood. But a fire department, on the other hand, will say the streets can only get so narrow because if you allow on-street parking, and there's parking on both sides, we can't get our fire truck through there. So that's I always think of it as the accordion effect. You know, what is not too narrow to prevent some, you know, cause safety issues, but what is also narrow enough that you get the beneficial effects, such as slowing traffic through a neighborhood, and may keep, you know, you haven't, you really do, developers say, well, that costs too much for us to develop. You really, if you think about it, you have some real incentive to keep development costs down for developers because it keeps your property values affordable for people that then want to buy homes. So those last four or five pages, there's different ways to think about them. But we worked through those with Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. We worked through a lot faster than in the 20 minutes that we did right here. I mean, a lot slower than we did in 20 minutes right here, and went through a lot of those issues.
Yeah. Question.
Yeah.
On page 20, you have at the top, you have, there's paragraphs B, C, and D, and have to do with the developer contributing land to various things. Mm-hmm. But in every case there, it says may. And so how do you make that determination whether he will? Because if it says may, he's going to say, that means I don't have to. And if, you know, other places, so we say shall.
Well, yeah, that's where I said, you know, sometimes that, and when we're going through that, it's a little touchy subject. Yeah. There is constitutional law that says anything that you require from a developer has to be in proportion to their impact.
Yeah.
So if someone's doing a 10-lot subdivision on 5 acres, half-acre lots, and you said, well, you know what, you're gonna have 10 new families there. We want you to dedicate an acre to us for a neighborhood park. The benefit is not proportional to their degree of impact. You're asking, you know, for something way over and above and beyond. But if there's a 400-lot subdivision on, say, 100 acres, you're probably within your right to say, we need an acre here or here, based upon the impact, and that's where you correspond and you look at, okay, what's the Park and Recreation District, their plans. They identify that they need neighborhood parks in these areas. And so you say, okay, they have a plan based on their plan and the impact. We see a need for you to dedicate that land. And it is on a case-by-case basis, and that's why it says may.
Okay.
Because if you just, you know, on the first example I gave, they could probably challenge you in court, and it's gone to court. The most famous case of all is, I'll take you through it, is the Dolan case, and I'll give you the 60-second version. It was in Tigard, Oregon, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what it was the city of Tigard required A-Boy plumbing. They were doing a minor addition to their building for storage of equipment. There was a creek that ran behind their house, and there was their trails plan said, we want a trail along this. They saw that the site plan review to build this addition was their opportunity to require them to dedicate land and build this trail. And they said, you know, there's no, how is it related to what we're doing? People aren't coming to pick up the water heater on their bike, number one, and the cost of that is way out of proportion with any impact that we're having. And so that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. After millions of dollars, they won. And so that has been a test that's been used for about the past 15 years, to get at, is it proportional and is it rational in the first place? Long story short, that's why that's his name.
So, was there any discussion in this planning process, all of this stuff, about the fact that we are surrounded by government land and the need for lots of parks and stuff may not be as large as it would be in some other communities?
There was great discussion about open spaces and making sure that they connected and that there was maximum usage. When you look at the zoning map, you'll see places where green connects from the river over to the potential wayside, and then along the highway, and then in the mixed-use areas through the site plan approval process, and connecting with the parks district, you'll have new parks that connect to existing parks, to trails, to sidewalks, back to other parks. The requirement by law is not to consider what's outside the UGB, but make sure that each neighborhood can be sustainable on its own. So that's how we looked at open space.
So it's a state law that we had to go by percentage, is that what it is?
It's not by percentage, it's just that inside our UGB, we have three primary neighborhoods, and we have a concept called complete communities. And that requires us to look within the UGB for the open space that's available to us. The BLM, as you know, can sell off land to anyone. So that federal land around the city may not be there. But with inside the UGB, we have to plan for our own open space.
Mm-hmm. What happens over time is if you look at item D, it talks about system development charges for parks. If that's something the city moves toward adopting, system development charges where you're collecting money for parks, that money is transferred to the parks district. And oftentimes what we were successful doing when I administered this type of code was basically getting the park district and the developer together when they were designing the subdivision, so that the park district said, okay, well, you know, we really, on our plan shows that we have a park here. And sometimes you get a combination of the developer dedicating some land and the park district saying, if you dedicate the land, we will come in and use some of that money to build the park. So you're dedicating the land, you build the park. And then what happened was, because the park was going to be built, the developer was more than happy to dedicate that land because everyone wanted to live in a subdivision that had a park developed outright. So it became, they more than made up their money on the back end selling lots at a higher price and at a quicker rate versus the cost of the land that they dedicated for the park.
Yeah.
And so it was facilitating a conversation that really...
Well, and I know in a lot of communities that kind of thing is true. I just don't know if the demographics here dictate the same thing that we're seeing in a lot of other towns, because we do have a lot of, you know, we're pretty rural.
Yeah, and I think that's the main, gives you that ability to you know, look at something that might not meet that test.
Yeah.
One of the things we want to do at this point is determine where to focus our efforts for the next meeting. And I would like to make a suggestion that the council on its own read procedures and SDC format, because they're short and direct and really more step-by-step processes. If you could do that, then at the course of the meeting, we could focus on the meteor signs and lighting. Does that sound okay? Okay, good. That's what we'll do then. If you have questions in the meantime, you can email or call us about procedures or SDCs. You'll find the SDC ordinance a good format, but you don't have a TSP, and so it's a little hard to do much more than a format. But it will give you a good sense of how the city would implement SDCs.
And all the procedures ordinance does is all those application procedures that we talked about in zoning and subdivision code, it just says when somebody submits that, here's how you're going to conduct the review process and make it fair to everybody. It's the rules of the game.
Thank you very much.
It's dry, I know, but we have to go through it.
Yeah, that's playing with your
interest. I know.
It'll be dry when you put it into practice in the first application.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we'll see you on the
13th.
And
thank you.
We're now public comment. I'd like to thank Deborah, James, and Gloria for your work with that. It's been a long time coming, and see the council didn't throw it in the waste basket. They accepted about 90% of it.
You guys did a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
Really
thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further? Entertain a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Apollos?
Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks for that.